Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to Teck Resources' 2021 Investor and Analyst Day broadcast and conference call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer period after each session. This conference call is being recorded on Tuesday, September 21st, 2021. I would now like to turn the conference call over to Fraser Phillips, Senior Vice President, Investor Relations and Strategic Analysis. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Matt. Now, depending on where you're joining us from today, good morning or good afternoon to everyone. On behalf of the entire senior management team, welcome to Teck's 2021 Investor and Analyst Day. Our presentation is posted in the investor section of our website at teck.com. Please note that this event is being video recorded, and the recordings will be posted on our website later this week. Before we begin, please note today's presentation contains forward-looking statements regarding our business. Various risks and uncertainties may cause actual results to vary. Teck does not assume the obligation to update any forward-looking statements. Please refer to slides two and three for the assumptions underlying our forward-looking statements. Throughout this presentation, we will reference various non-GAAP measures. Explanations and reconciliations regarding these measures can be found in the appendices of our presentations and our most recent filed quarterly press release on our website. Today's presentation is divided into three sessions: strategy, operations, and ESG leadership. Don Lindsay, our President and Chief Executive Officer, will lead our strategy panel, which is focused on Teck's strategy to capitalize on our industry-leading copper growth profile as we rebalance our portfolio towards low-carbon metals. The session will include a review of our key commodity markets, updates on our QB2 copper growth project and on our copper growth strategy, and a discussion of our capital allocation priorities. Next, we will provide operational updates across our major business units, including the exciting progress on RACE21. The session will be led by Red Conger, our Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer. The third and final session will be with Marcia Smith, Senior Vice President of Sustainability and External Affairs. Marcia will provide an overview of Teck's commitment to ESG and our industry-leading performance. In order to make today's event as interactive as possible, we've allocated time for Q&A following each of the three panel discussions. We will wrap up the day with a final Q&A session and Don's closing remarks. Our presentation materials, including a replay of the webcast, will again be made available on teck.com. As a reminder to analysts and investors who wish to ask a question, please dial into the conference center. Please limit your questions to one per Q&A session so that as many people as possible can participate. With that, let's kick off our first session on strategy. Don will begin with an overview. He will be followed by Réal Foley, Senior Vice President of Marketing and Logistics in our key commodity markets. Next will be Red, along with Alex Christopher, our Senior Vice President of Exploration, Projects, and Technical Services, with an update on QB2. After that, Nick Hooper, Senior Vice President of Corporate Development, will review our copper growth strategy. Finally, Jonathan Price, our Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, will provide a summary of our financial strategy, including capital allocation. Don, with that, over to you.
Well, thanks very much, Fraser, and welcome everyone. Thank you all for joining us today. I'm going to begin with an overview of how Teck is poised for growth. These next couple of years are going to be a very exciting phase in our company's history. I'm going to go through an update on our health and safety performance and sustainability performance and some of the key changes to our management team over the last year. I'll go through the positioning that we have in a decarbonizing world and what we believe is an industry-leading growth profile in copper, and conclude with a review of our solid track record of returning cash to shareholders. Starting on slide two, as I said, this is a very exciting time for both our industry and for Teck itself. There are opportunities ahead as global growth and the transition to a lower carbon economy drive new metal demand, particularly for copper. Now, we're also focused on delivering strong operating results and strong free cash flow by taking advantage of the current favorable commodity price environment, particularly with steelmaking coal prices that are actually around $399 US per ton on an FOB basis and over $570 US per ton on a CFR China basis. We believe that tech is one of the best positioned companies globally to capitalize on the strong demand growth that we see for copper, with one of the very best copper production growth profiles in the industry. And in the process, we expect to continue to reduce carbon as a proportion of our total business, while continuing to produce the essential metals and minerals required for a low-carbon world. We're also continuing to strengthen our existing high-quality, low-carbon assets through our RACE 21 Technology and Innovation Program, which is harnessing cutting-edge technologies to drive step-change improvements in productivity, efficiency, safety, and sustainability. And at the same time, we strive to maintain the highest standards of sustainability, safety, and operational excellence in everything we do. And we have a leadership team with the right mix of skills and experience to deliver on our strategy. Turning to slide three, health and safety is a core value for tech. We continue to make progress in our health and safety and our sustainability performance, as you see on the slide. We have reduced our rate of high potential incidents by 80% since 2016 and by 38% year to date. As we work towards building a more inclusive workplace, we have enhanced representation and diversity across the company, with women comprising 28% of the senior management team and one-third of all new hires. We are rebalancing our portfolio, as Fraser mentioned, towards low-carbon metals and have goals that address the climate challenges. We have made a commitment to be carbon neutral across all of our operations and activities by 2050, with an interim target to reduce our carbon intensity by 33% by 2030. We are serving the needs of our communities and Indigenous peoples with 24% of our procurement spend with local suppliers and with 72 active agreements with Indigenous peoples. And we are implementing innovative water management and water treatment solutions to protect water quality downstream of all of our operations and all the time reducing our water use. We expect to triple our water treatment capacity in the Elk Valley this year, and we have achieved a 13% reduction in freshwater use at our Chilean operations to date. At the same time, while we are proud of health and safety, our health and safety performance and our sustainability performance, we do know there is more work to be done to keep pace with the expectations of our stakeholders. Now, addressing key changes to our management team on slide four, we have had a significant renewal of our senior management team over the past year, including new hires, promotions, retirements, and restructuring. We've had a number of recent changes, including Sarah Hughes was appointed VP Assurance and Advisory this past April, overseeing Tech's Enterprise Assurance Program and the Assurance and Advisory team. Sarah joined us from Trevally, where she was VP Risk and Assurance. And previously, Sarah held a number of senior roles at Goldcorp and was Group Internal Auditor for British Petroleum in London. Brianne Metzger-Dorn was appointed VP Health and Safety in May, replacing Laws Watkins, who retired on June 15th. Brianne joined us from Enbridge, where she was VP Safety and Reliability and brings to the role more than 20 years of experience in health and safety, continuous improvement, and risk management and compliance. Don Sander was appointed VP Planning and Innovation for our coal business in November. He was previously the general manager of our Elkview operation. And in his new role, Don is responsible for aspects of sustainable resource development and business improvement initiatives in the steelmaking coal business. Nick Uzelak was appointed VP Legal in November. Nick brings to his role nearly 20 years of legal practice experience with a focus on securities law and M&A. Dr. Joshua Tepper was appointed Tech's Chief Medical Officer in July. Dr. Tepper is responsible for guiding the development and implementation of company-wide occupational health systems and medical programs, which, of course, has had a significant focus on our COVID programs to date. Dr. Tepper brings extensive experience as a family physician and a health system leader, most recently as President and CEO of North York General Hospital. And Helen Kelly was appointed Director of Investor Relations in September. She joined us from Aritzia, where she was VP Investor Relations for the past 2 years. She brings more than a decade of investor relations experience to the role, largely in oil and gas, and including both Suncor and MEG Energy. Next slide, please. So as I said at the opening, it's a very exciting time to be in this industry. The unprecedented global monetary and fiscal stimulus in response to the COVID-19 pandemic has increased demand for the metals and minerals essential for a low-carbon world, including copper, zinc, and steelmaking coal. And the forecast near-term economic recovery, as vaccine uptake continues, is expected to further increase demand at a time when inventories of many of these metals and minerals are at historically low levels. At the same time, long-term demand forecasts are strong, driven by decarbonization, population growth, and a rising middle class. In copper, significant growth in demand is expected from power generation and grid infrastructure, storage, charging infrastructure, and electric vehicles. And overall, CRU expects copper demand in these end uses to grow at a 26% cumulative growth rate between now and 2030. Tech is well positioned to capitalize on this increase in copper demand. We expect to double our consolidated copper production by 2023 with the startup of QB2. As shown on slide 6, we believe that high-quality seaborne steelmaking coal will continue to be an essential input for production of the steel that's needed for infrastructure development, including that required to support electrification and decarbonization. Over the long term, demand for seaborne steelmaking coal is forecast to remain robust, fueled by growth in blast furnace steel production in regions such as India and Southeast Asia, which have limited scrap availability and little to no access to domestic or overland hard coking coal supply. The market share for seaborne steelmaking coal imports in these developing economies is forecast to increase from about one-third currently to more than half by 2050. And supply growth is clearly constrained, as shown in the graph on this slide. Without the addition of confirmed and unconfirmed greenfield and brownfield projects, there will be a significant gap to steelmaking coal demand between 2025 and 2030, which is not very far off. We recognize the need for the steel sector to decarbonize in support of global climate goals, and we have done a great deal of work to understand the long-term resilience of steelmaking coal demand in a decarbonizing world, both internally and with external experts. And you can find a summary of that work in the appendix of our marketing document, which is available in the investors section of our website. Our analysis suggests that in order to meet the world's decarbonization targets, the steel industry is unlikely to converge on a single emission abatement technology, and it's more likely a range of technologies will need to be deployed as they become commercially viable. Of these technologies, blast furnace plus carbon capture utilization and storage, or CCUS, is the most cost competitive and commercially viable solution for large-scale adoption, unlikely to be displaced at scale by any other technology this half century. It is also the only abatement technology capable of decarbonizing the steelmaking industry at the rate and scale that is required by 2050, and that drives continued demand for Teck's high-quality seaborne hard coking coal. Teck's premium hard coking coal also has properties that improve blast furnace efficiency and decrease CO2 emissions per ton of steel, optimally positioning it for a decarbonizing future. On slide 7, we believe that Teck's strategy will ensure that we remain well-positioned now and in the future for the transition to a low-carbon world. In the near term, our focus on copper growth will rebalance our portfolio and make Teck a major copper producer. At the same time, it will reduce the proportion of our total business that is derived from carbon, including steelmaking coal. In the medium term, we plan to prudently grow our copper business as an area essential to the transition to a low-carbon world. In the process, we expect to reduce carbon as a proportion of our total business while continuing to produce the high-quality steelmaking coal required for the low-carbon transition. In longer term, we aim to be the leading copper producer supplying essential metals for a low-carbon world. As I mentioned earlier, we have set a target to be carbon neutral by 2050 with interim goals for 2030. We intend to continue to progress carbon reduction initiatives that are already underway in our operations to achieve our carbon neutrality by avoiding, eliminating, and minimizing emissions. These include transitioning to renewable power sources, switching to low emissions mining fleets, and implementing efficiency improvements, among other measures. Next slide, please. Accelerating capital-efficient growth in copper is the cornerstone of our strategy. By growing our copper business and leveraging our industry-leading copper production growth profile, we will become a major copper producer. As I said a few moments ago, we will rebalance our portfolio, making carbon, including steelmaking coal, a much smaller overall proportion of our business at the same time. We're also continuing to strengthen our existing assets through our RACE 21 Technology and Innovation Program, which Andrew Milner will speak to shortly. And everything we do is underpinned by a focus on disciplined capital allocation and maximizing returns of cash to shareholders. We will rigorously assess and balance future opportunities for growth with providing cash returns to shareholders underpinned by a strong balance sheet. And of course, we remain committed to leadership in ESG performance. We believe Teck is one of the best positioned companies globally to capitalize on the strong demand growth we see for copper. We're already a significant copper producer from our four existing mines, but more importantly, as shown on slide 9, we have one of the very best copper production growth profiles in the whole industry. As I've already noted, by 2023, Teck will have doubled our consolidated copper production as we complete construction of QB2. And this compares to an average copper production growth profile of just 21% for our diversified mining peers and only 11% growth for our copper peers. And these numbers are according to Wood Mackenzie. So Teck provides investors with strong copper growth exposure at a time when copper demand is set to increase significantly. In addition to QB2, our well-understood resource base creates multiple growth options, as illustrated on slide 10. And these are high-quality resources in very attractive and well-established mineral districts, including Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Chile, and Peru. These options also include approximately 22 million ounces of measured and indicated gold resources and a further 10 million ounces of gold in inferred resources. We are making prudent investments to further define the path to value for each asset, leveraging our exploration, development, and commercial expertise with a strong sustainability and community focus. Our continued investment has resulted in a robust pipeline in copper, which is something that many of our peers simply do not have. Next slide, please. Everything we do is underpinned by a focus on disciplined capital allocation. We optimize how we deploy what we call available cash flow in our capital allocation framework, balancing between returning additional cash to shareholders and investing in copper growth. Jonathan Price will speak to this in more detail in just a few minutes. Teck has a solid track record of cash returns to shareholders with over $4.9 billion of dividends and buybacks from 2011 to 2020, as shown in slide 11. And I would be remiss if I did not highlight the significant potential for EBITDA generation from current steelmaking coal prices. We estimate our annualized EBITDA to increase by approximately $1.5 billion Canadian for every $50 US per ton increase in the steelmaking coal price. In summary, on slide 12, this is indeed a very exciting time for our industry and for Teck itself. There are opportunities ahead as global growth and the transition to a lower carbon economy drive new copper metal demand. And we have an industry-leading copper growth profile and a very attractive copper pipeline. We're strengthening how we operate, both through cutting-edge innovation to improve productivity, as well as leading ESG performance. And we have a leadership team with the right mix of skills and experience to deliver on our strategy. And with that, I'll turn it over now to Rael Foley, our Senior Vice President, Marketing Logistics, on the current state of affairs and outlook for our major commodities. So, Rael, over to you.
Thank you, Don, and good morning or good afternoon. In my presentation today, I will provide an overview of the markets for steelmaking coal, copper, and zinc, and what I can say is what a difference a year makes. So starting on slide 2, the steelmaking coal prices diverged with the China import ban on Australian coal, as shown on the far right of the top chart. And as Don said, China CFR prices are at an all-time high around US$580 per ton today, and the current FOB Australia price is above US$390 per ton. So the market is definitely very tight. The global increase in demand for steel is one of the main drivers for the coal prices. Global crude steel production is up by around 125 million tons at around 2 billion tons year-to-date annualized. And the crude steel increase ex-China is more than double the China increase. Steel production remains high to capture record high steel prices and strong margins. The iron ore price lost above US$100 per ton since peaking in May this year, leaving steel mills with capability to pay for coal. Steelmakers ex-China continue to run on low coal stocks, and customers are trying to secure supply for Q4 ahead of the rainy season in Australia. We're also receiving inquiries from customers who have not purchased from Teck recently, again illustrating supply tightness. On the supply side on slide 3, the main price drivers follow. China's ban on Australian coal imports has been relatively absorbed by the global market, but has continued to impact China. Previously, Australia exported around 30 to 35 million tons per year to China. It took around 6 months for trade flows to rebalance, as we suggested back in November 2020. India, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and Southeast Asia reflect the largest year-over-year increase in Australian coal imports, as seen on the top chart. Increase in steel demand globally helped move the Australian coal, but left the Chinese market undersupplied by around 13 to 20 million tons, as shown on the bottom chart. China planned on increased domestic mine production and also increased imports from Mongolia and seaborne imports to offset the losses from Australia. While domestic mine production and seaborne imports increased year over year, Mongolia is down a further 9 million tons year-to-date annualized, following a 10 million ton drop in 2020. China domestic production continues to be challenged by safety inspection, with increased production now expected to be half of forecast at the start of 2021. And at the same time, port inventories are low, and end-user inventories are at multi-year lows. COVID is continuing to impact Mongolia exports to China. China's seaborne August year-to-date annualized coal imports ex-Australia are running at record high levels, exceeding the previous record high in 2013. Ex-Australia continued to divert tons to China to capture the record high CFR China prices. Keep in mind that in 2013, China crude steel production was around 780 million tons. So that is more than 300 million tons below the current production level, which clearly shows that the coal market is very tight. We're hearing rumors that some suppliers are sold out through October or longer. While we can't be certain of the length of time that this pricing environment will continue, indications are that the ban on Australian coal will continue into 2022. And what is certain is that the market is very tight. July year-to-date annualized coal production by the key seaborne exporters is down around 17 million tons versus the pre-COVID 2019 levels, while crude steel production is up around 125 million tons over the same period. Looking at the medium to long term on slide 4, steelmaking coal and particularly hard coking coal demand will be supported by expansion and builds of blast furnaces in Southeast Asia and India. Asia has already committed to 20 plus years of traditional steelmaking technology, And the chart on the right shows a country split with India representing around 60% of the brownfield and greenfield expansions. As Don mentioned, steel production will be critical for global efforts on decarbonization. Its use in almost all green energy and storage projects will increase in coming years. And while the world makes every effort to decarbonize, efficient technology has not been developed yet to replace the primary steelmaking capacity using the traditional blast furnace and BOF route. The steel industry will look at several alternatives to transition to a low-carbon environment, including carbon capture, usage, and storage to reduce carbon emissions. Scrap will also be a factor in reducing emissions, but is not a silver bullet as we're seeing today and this year. Scrap has not been able to keep up with demand despite record high steel prices. Now shifting to base metals on slide five with copper. Copper is an essential element in the reduction of carbon emissions globally. The rapid expansion of green energy, energy storage, and emissions-free transportation are adding to the demand growth for copper. A number of mining projects will come online in 2023 and 2024. That could temporarily meet these demand projections, but the supply response is falling short per the top chart. Note that 80% of the projects were sanctioned prior to the pandemic and prior to the rapid escalation in the move forward in green energy. Demand for copper is forecast to grow by more than 12 million tons in the next 10 years to meet accelerated IEA targets. In the last 20 years, by comparison, during the economic transition in China, copper mine production only grew by 7 million tons. And currently, only 2.4 million tons have been committed out of that 12 million tons required in the next 10 years. So demand for copper continues to accelerate as more companies move to lower emissions. Automakers, for instance, in the last 3 months alone have raised or brought forward their five-year targets for full EV fleets by 8% per the bottom chart. This is an 8% increase in end-use demand versus what was projected only 3 months ago. Many industries are now struggling to keep up with the rapid pace of change. It is estimated that the current electric grid will require over 10% increase in capacity just to meet the near-term targets of global 40% EV penetration. Turning to the zinc market on slide six, the market continues to underestimate the changes taking place. Chinese mine production continues to underperform expectations. We expect Chinese zinc mine production will remain relatively flat in the coming years, with some expansions offset by lower grades and lower production at other mines. This will result in an increase of imported concentrate into China, per the light blue bars on the top chart. In the short term, energy restrictions impacted some smelter production, offset by continuing logistic issues in South America, including the shortage of vessels and containers. The zinc concentrate market remained tight this year, with treatment charges stable in the U.S. $70 to $90 range. And the zinc metal market also exceeded expectations in 2021. For instance, premiums in the American market are now in the 8.75 to 11 U.S. cents per pound range, levels last seen a number of years ago. Global galvanized steel is increasing, with galvanized sheet prices hitting record highs despite a slowdown in auto production due to a shortage of computer chips. We see this pent-up demand continuing well into 2022, with some suggesting auto prices could remain high into 2023 on supply shortages. As mentioned earlier, decarbonization will require steel. Galvanized steel extends the service life of steel and reduces scrapping and thereby carbon emissions. With that, I'll turn it over to Red Conger and Alex Christopher to provide an update on our near-term copper growth project, QB2.
Thanks, Rial. I'm Red Conger, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, and I'm joined today by Alex Christopher, our Senior Vice President of Explorations, Projects, and Technical Services. We're going to take the next 10 minutes or so and talk to you about the significant progress we've been making at QB2 and give you a snapshot of our current construction and commissioning focus. We won't repeat what Don has highlighted or reiterate much of what you already know regarding the quality and attractiveness of Quebrada Blanca as one of the world's premier undeveloped copper deposits. But before I start with the update, I wanted to remind you of the size and scope of the infrastructure that we are developing at this brownfield site, where we expect to produce 316,000 tons of copper equivalent and concentrate annually over the first 5 full years of operation. We're constructing a 143,000-ton-a-day conventional copper concentrator, a tailings facility with a capacity for a 28-year mine life, 165-kilometers-long concentrate and water pipelines, a port facility that includes a desalinization plant and concentrate filtration plant, as well as supporting infrastructure such as power lines, electrical substations, and roads. Now over to Alex to take you through progress and key focus areas.
Okay, thanks, Red. So starting on slide 2, the overall construction is advancing very well across the project. We continue to gain steady progress, surpassing 60% overall project progress in early August. And absent another significant wave of COVID, we remain confident we'll achieve first copper production in the second half of 2022. The project's team response to the significant second wave of COVID in Chile in the first half of 2021 was nothing short of exceptional. Our focus on vaccinations and our strong COVID protocols, including extensive proactive testing, continue to be very effective and have been key to the successful advancement of the project. Chile has cited our efforts as a model for managing workplace health and safety during these unprecedented times, and Bechtel indicates that QB2 is one of their best performing projects worldwide for managing the spread of the virus. The capital estimate remains unchanged at US$5.2 billion before COVID impacts, and our estimate of COVID capital cost impact, as highlighted in our most recent quarterly conference call, is US$600 million. I'm proud to say that as of this morning, the project workforce is currently over 82% fully vaccinated, with over 90% of the workers having received at least one dose. So with COVID cases in Chile declining, coupled with the higher rates of vaccination in the country and in the project workforce, we're aggressively ramping up the workforce levels with a focus on delivering to the project's key milestones. And we're doing this in a coordinated fashion by collaborating with Bechtel and the various construction contractors to build on our ramp-up and construction success to date. This includes initiatives and incentive programs to continue to drive behaviors that will successfully deliver results and keep major project areas on track to achieve our targeted first production date. The project's focus and critical path remains the grinding circuit at the concentrator. The photo you see here on the right of the slide shows the coarse ore stockpile area back in June, where we're well advanced with the dome foundation, stacker structure, and reclaim tunnels. We're also maintaining a strong focus on other important construction areas, including the port-to-pond infrastructure, which will provide water for commissioning of the concentrator. So moving on to the next slide, given the advanced stage of construction, with first copper rapidly approaching, we have considerable efforts directed at operational readiness and commissioning to ensure a successful startup and a seamless transition to operations. As a major new project, QB2 is being built from the ground up to incorporate leading technologies and innovation, including our state-of-the-art integrated operations center, which will drive value by linking people, process, and workplace design. The The facility has been designed so that multidisciplinary operations teams, including our integrated planning group, value chain optimization, process control, and reliability, will have real-time visibility and tools to remotely manage operations at QB2. Our operations leadership team is already in place, and we're actively ramping up the operations workforce as we undertake pre-commissioning and commissioning activities on systems as they're turned over. Each of the operational areas listed here has multiple systems and subsystems that need to be commissioned and operated, with a number of these starting just this year. Our operations and commissioning teams are working closely in collaboration with our construction and corporate groups to ensure successful delivery and startup. So in the foreground of this July photo on slide 4, you can see our progress in advancing the jetty from both onshore and offshore work fronts. In the background, you can see the construction activities on the desalination plant, pump station, facilities for receiving and loading the concentrate onto ships, and our electrical substation, which will start commissioning later this year. The desalination plant will be one of the first facilities that will be commissioned in order to deliver waters to the tailings management facility and support commissioning of the concentrator. Construction of the linear works, which includes the pipelines, pump stations, 23 kilovolt substations, and 220 kilovolt power transmission lines, are in full swing, and these facilities are all well advanced. Slide 5 shows a starter dam at the tailings management facility, where we continue to raise the dam in preparation for storage of the desalinated water that we'll be using for commissioning and operations. At the tailings management facility, work is ongoing on the tailings transport system, as well as other work areas related to tailings deposition and water recovery. And it's important to note here that we're using our new CAT 794 truck fleet to deliver the materials to the dam, and the fleet is performing very well. This has effectively commissioned a portion of the QB2 fleet ahead of pre-stripping and other mining activities. In addition, we're well advanced in the commissioning and testing of the autonomous haul system in advance of pre-stripping activities later this year. Slide 6 provides a view of the concentrator grinding area, which continued progress very well, and which remains the critical or longest path for the project. All 6 mills are in place, and we continue to advance the structural, electrical, and mechanical components, as well as piping and cabling. There are several discrete systems and subsystems at the mine and mill area which are required to be in place over time to support the commissioning and ramp up of the concentrator, and these include the flotation circuit, which is well advanced with all the tanks now in place. Other systems, such as the primary crusher and ore delivery systems, as well as the concentrate and tailings thickeners, are well advanced, and the associated mine area facilities, including both the mine loop and the truck shop, are planned for completion and commissioning later this year. This critical work front is progressing well, and we're working to ensure that the systems are in place to support the commissioning of first copper. So moving on to slide 7, we're committed to achieving first copper as quickly as possible. And to summarize the prior 3 slides, there are 3 key systems required for first copper: the desalination plant, sufficient water storage capacity at the tailings management facility, and the line 1 crushing, grinding, and flotation systems. Commissioning of the desalination plant will provide water to be pumped through the pipeline for placement in the tailings management facility, which will be used for commissioning to produce copper concentrate. And the project team is laser focused on ensuring these 3 systems are delivered and commissioned on schedule. The keys to successful delivery of first copper remain our partnership with Bechtel and ensuring alignment of the construction, commissioning, and operating teams across Teck, Bechtel, and contractors. Going forward, there were 2 key major focus areas: execution on the critical path of the concentrator and delivering the port-to-pond infrastructure that are key to enable the commissioning and startup. The push to finish is all about first copper as soon as possible in the second half of 2022. With that, thank you, and I'll turn this over to Nick Hooper to speak to you on our copper growth strategy.
Thank you, Alex. Good morning or good afternoon. As Don highlighted in his introduction, accelerating copper growth is the cornerstone of our strategy. By leveraging our leading copper growth profile, we will become a leading copper producer. Teck is well positioned to realize value from a robust and diverse pipeline of copper-dominant base metal projects. Everything we do is underpinned by a commercial value-focused approach combined with disciplined capital allocation. In the next few minutes, I'm going to highlight that we have the right approach, the right assets, and the right team to achieve our copper growth aspiration. On slide two, our approach to the developments of QB2 illustrates how we are thinking about our copper growth pipeline. In the lead up to QB2 development decision, we de-risked the project from a technical, permitting, social, and environmental perspective. We right-sized our balance sheet through the repayment of $4 billion U.S. of debt and regained our investment-grade credit rating. We returned 1.9 billion Canadian to shareholders in the form of dividends and share buybacks. We reduced our project equity funding exposure through the U.S. $1.2 billion partnering transaction with SMM and Sumitomo Corp, and a competitively priced $2.5 billion project financings. As we did in QB2, recognizing investors' focus on cash returns and free cash flow yields, as part of adhering to our capital allocation framework, we will seek to reduce on an opportunity-by-opportunity basis tax equity requirements for future growth through partnering, streams, infrastructure carve-outs, and project financing. Let me repeat, we will adhere to our rigorous capital allocation framework to balance growth and cash returns to shareholders. On the next slide, I want to stress that it is by design Teck is in this fortuitous position to have such a robust pipeline of growth projects. The longstanding corporate goal has been to consistently invest, cycle in, cycle out, in large, high-quality ore bodies, and thereby sustain Teck for the following generation. This approach is one where we constantly strive to increase the quality of the portfolio by methodically advancing our medium-term and future growth options. As this slide illustrates, Teck's copper growth portfolio is supported by extensive studies that have been completed over the last 5 years. Alongside technical analysis, we have pursued a comprehensive and considered approach to community relations and permitting. This foundational work provides the basis upon which Teck can recognize value from these options. Ultimately, our competitive advantage is a result of actively advancing our portfolio of copper growth options over the last 5 years or so, while the rest of the industry hasn't. The end result is that Teck is extremely well positioned, perhaps better than any of our competitors, to maximize value from copper demand growth well beyond the ramp-up of QB2. On slide four, our portfolio of copper growth options from a relative risk and return perspective. We have a suite of copper projects which vary by demand type, deposit type, scale, jurisdiction, and stage of advancement. As Red articulated, QB2 is in execution and set to deliver value in the near term. Zafranal and San Nicolas are nearing the point where value can be realized. QB3 and Galore are attractive medium-term options, which we will systematically advance in the coming years. Waver Union, Shaft Creep, and Mesaba are future options with compelling scope, scale, and value improvement potentials. Details of these future options are included in the appendix to the Investor Day presentation, which can be found on the website. On slide five, we provide an overview of the key attributes of Zafranal, which is located in southern Peru. A feasibility study and subsequent value-added study was completed in mid-2019 and early 2020, which substantiated Zafranal as a quality, mid-sized, capital-efficient copper gold development opportunity with a 19-year mine life and mine life extension potential. Zafranal distinguishes itself from other development opportunities in southern Peru due to its favorable location to infrastructure and moderate elevation. Good grade super gene enriched mineralization in the early mine life, roughly about 2.5 times the grade at the mine life, allows for rapid payback, about 2.5 years, attractive cash costs, and investment returns. In August of this year, we submitted the SEIA, which upon approval will increase our ability to realize value from Zafranal. Leading up to the SEIA submission, we strengthened our community engagement at the local regional, and national levels while establishing and maintaining a high level of collaboration and coordination with the proven regulators. Our focus over the next year will be to secure the SEIA and make prudent investments to improve capital and operating costs and realize mine life extension opportunities. As the review of the SEIA continues, and once COVID constraints are reduced, we will consider our value realization options at Zafranal. Slide 6 provides an overview of San Nicolas project located in central Mexico, in Zacatecas state, one of the country's key mining states. A pre-feasibility study was completed in Q1 2021 that demonstrates San Nicolas as a high-quality, mid-size copper-zinc massive sulfide development opportunity with robust economics tied to high average copper and zinc grades through the 15-year mine life. San Nicolas has a favorable location, which results in very competitive development and operating costs. Initiation of the feasibility study and submission of permitting applications are expected to be made in the next quarter or so. In addition to initiating the feasibility study and advancing permits, we are considering a range of development options, including partnering, that will improve our ability to advance the development of San Nicolas in a prudent, capital-efficient, and timely manner. On page 7, we highlight our two medium-term copper development projects, QB3 and Galore. Both are underpinned by high-quality, large resources with compelling production, operating costs, and competitive capital efficiency profiles in attractive jurisdictions. Social engagement for both assets is well advanced, and we will strengthen these as these projects evolve. The QB hypogene resource base allows us to consider potential increases to QB2 production by 50 up to 200%, with corresponding incremental increases in QB2 EBITDA. Capital intensity is expected to be low to medium due to QB2 brownfield environment and related economies of scale that will improve cost competitiveness. The sequence and timing to realize the full potential of the significant resource base at QB will be a key component of the QB3 pre-feasibility study. At Galore Creek, work is underway to complete a pre-feasibility study by the first half of 2023. The high-grade copper, gold, silver resource of this porphyry deposit is one of the key contributors to its attractive operating costs and capital intensity. It is worth noting that QB3 benefits from a contingent payment from SMM and Sumitomo Corp, and Galore Creek is a 50-50 partnership with Newmont. In both cases, this will reduce Teck's equity exposure and development risk. Any future development decision on these projects will be based on completion of thorough development studies focused on de-risking each investment from a technical, permitting, social environment perspective, and will be subject to our rigorous capital allocation framework. Any decision will favor the most compelling investment opportunity, and like we did when QB2 was sanctioned, include considered returns of cash to shareholders prior to a development decision being made. In closing, I want to stress that in addition to having the right approach and the right asset to realize value from our robust pipeline of copper growth projects, we have the right team with the necessary technical, project development, ESG, commercial, and leadership depth and experience. Executing QB2 is adding significantly to our development experience and mindset, which will enhance delivery of our copper growth strategy. With that, I'll hand it over to Jonathan Price, our Chief Financial Officer, who will outline our financial strategy.
Thank you, Nick. I'm going to focus today on Teck's financial strategy, central to which is our capital allocation framework. In doing so, we will review Teck's strong balance sheet and liquidity. We will dive into our largest ever capital investment, QB2, and look at both the QB2 funding model and the terms of the project finance facility. And finally, we will look ahead to our potential cash flow position once QB2 is operating at its stated potential to highlight the returns that might be available under a range of scenarios. I'll begin on slide 2 with a recap of our capital allocation framework, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It all starts with the inflow of the cash we generate from our operations. We maximize this through running our operations as safely and productively as possible, supported by our tireless efforts in continuous improvement in the RACE 21 transformation program. In terms of the cash outflows, we first take care of the sustaining capital that underpins the integrity and reliability of our operations, including equipment replacement and maintenance. In addition, we provide for our committed growth capital, which in 2021 includes QB2, Neptune, spending on our studies for future growth options, and investment in our RACE 21 activities. Next, we check the health of our balance sheet or capital structure, which for us means keeping our net debt at a level that will see us maintain a solid investment grade rating through the cycle. And we pay our annual base dividend of 20 cents per share, which is distributed quarterly. Once these uses of cash have been deducted from our operating cash flows, we are left with our available cash flow. Of this, we pay out at least 30% as distributions to shareholders, with the remaining amounts available for growth projects or for further shareholder returns. Therefore, the framework allows for a minimum of 30% and up to 100% of available cash flow to be returned to shareholders. These returns can take the form of dividends or buybacks or a combination of both, and this will be determined based on consultation with major shareholders and having regard to the expected returns generated from buying back our own shares. As I'll explain in the coming slides, one of the most anticipated benefits of bringing QB2 online is the additional cash flow we expected to generate and the optionality that this could give us around balancing ongoing growth and shareholder returns. Next slide, please. Our current strong balance sheet will be a key enabler of our ability to balance prudent future growth in copper with attractive returns to shareholders, and this is very much by design. We've kept a conservative level of long-term debt on the balance sheet with no significant maturities until 2030 and many extending beyond 2040. We also have access to over $6 billion Canadian of liquidity. Finally, our existing production portfolio has substantial leverage to rising commodity prices. The chart on the upper right-hand side of this slide shows that, for example, a US $50 per ton increase in the price of coal for a year could add approximately $1.5 billion to our EBITDA based on 26 million tons of annual production. Now on to slide 4 and the funding model for QB2. Looking back to January 2019 and running through to the end of 2022, at which point the construction of QB2 is expected to be complete. Before getting into the detail, the eagle-eyed among you will notice that the ownership percentage shown here only sums to 90%. This is because we've excluded the 10% of Anami, given they don't contribute to project capex. As most of you know, we have a US $5.2 billion QB2 capital budget, which provides for both escalation and contingency, and our spending remains in line with this budget. This excludes the COVID capital that we have highlighted to you over the last several quarters. Of this US $5.2 billion spend, $2.5 billion will come from our project finance facility, with the remaining being contributed by Teck and our Sumitomo partners. In terms of the contributions from our Sumitomo partners, we've reflected here the full buy-in, as well as the subsequent proportional capital contributions, all being attributed to the stated capital budget. As such, the historical contributions from Teck from 2019 through 2021 are a balancing item. Now looking ahead to 2022, we expect to draw the remaining US $300 million of the project finance facility, with equity contributions totaling US $1 billion, split two-thirds, one-third between Teck and our Sumitomo partners, respectively. Finally, worth noting that while Teck retains a 60% interest in QB2, our contributions to project capital have been minimized through a well-thought-out funding and partnership model. Next slide, please. Slide 5 provides some further details regarding the project finance facility. These are important as you think about modeling our debt guarantees as well as our debt repayment post-QB2 completion. The facility requires that we fund debt equity at a 37% to 63% ratio. We and our partners contributed a significant amount of equity up front, which meant that after the closing of the project finance facility, we used primarily debt to fund QB2 construction for an extended period of time. This past spring, we had drawn enough on the project finance facility to achieve the required debt equity ratio, and therefore we and our partners began contributing equity to the project once again. The project finance facility is guaranteed on a pro rata basis before the project is complete, but these guarantees fall away after we achieve various industry standard operational completion tests and becomes non-recourse. Importantly, the project finance facility will begin to amortize no later than June 15, 2023, at about US $300 million a year. This is made up of semi-annual amortization payments of US $147 million each. We're also required to repay some debt as QB2 pays dividends up to its equity partners. I highlight this to show that there is a decent amount of natural deleveraging built into our project finance facility, and this will augment our goal of disciplined debt repayment after QB2 is complete. Now, we know that there's a lot of anticipation in the market about the project coming online. As such, we've put together some illustrated scenarios on slides 6 and 7 to give you a picture of what our cash flows and capital allocations might look like once QB2 is operational. Important that I emphasize that this is not guidance. As you know, we don't give cash flow or EBITDA guidance. So to construct this, we've taken actual first half numbers and flexed them based on our publicly disclosed commodity price sensitivities and combined this with our current guidance in other areas. The point is to give you all a better sense of how transformative QB2 could be for our cash flows and how much optionality that will then give us with respect to both shareholder returns and growth. I'll explain briefly how we've arrived at these scenarios. To start, we annualized first half 2021 EBITDA. As a reminder, our average copper price in the first half was $4.13 a pound, our average zinc price was $1.29 a pound, and our average steelmaking coal price was $137 per ton. Next, we adjust this annualized first half EBITDA for a higher FOB steelmaking coal price of $199 per ton US, which is a combination of August year-to-date pricing and the spot price when we constructed these scenarios. We use this same coal price for all three scenarios, and the adjustment is based on our publicly disclosed EBITDA sensitivities that I mentioned earlier. Next, we flex the copper price based on these same sensitivities to show hypothetical adjusted EBITDA from the current portfolio at $4.50, $4, and $3.50 copper. Finally, we add QB2 EBITDA based on 290,000 tons of annual production, a C1 cash cost of US $1.28 per pound, and the copper price in each scenario. With these EBITDA numbers as a basis, we deduct key cost items, cash taxes, cash interest, and lease payments to determine operating cash flow. Next, in accordance with our capital allocation framework, we deduct sustaining and growth capital, as well as capitalized stripping, and our base dividend. For these deductions, again, we either annualize first half 2021 numbers or base them on our public guidance for 2021. And then finally, we subtract our project finance facility amortization of roughly Canadian 400 million. And I'll note that this does not include additional debt that would be repaid alongside dividends per the restricted payments clause of the project finance facility. Next slide, please. So the outcome of these scenarios is that, depending on the copper price, once QB2 is operating as planned, we could generate between 2.2 and 3.1 billion of available cash flow, which is roughly between $4 and $6 per share. As you will recall, the first 30% of this is returned to shareholders, while the balance of 70% could also be returned to shareholders or can be deployed to additional growth options in the portfolio or a combination of the two. And as the metrics at the base of the slide show, we could do all of this while maintaining a very strong balance sheet. So based on what I've shared here, I hope you can see why we're so excited about the near-term potential of the business, and specifically the contribution of QB2. We're getting ever closer to a major inflection point as we transition from significant cash outflows to fund the development of QB2 to to the potential for significant EBITDA generation from a world-class copper operation. These cash flow scenarios highlight the potential for increased capital returns coupled with prudent growth of our copper business. And with that, I will pass it back to Don. Don.
Well, thanks very much, Jonathan. Now, before we go to Q&A, I do want to make a brief comment. Most of you, if in fact not all of you, will have seen the rumors reported last week concerning the possible sale or restructuring of our coal business. I want to say that we do not comment on market rumors or speculation, and we are not going to address those rumors or other questions about specific potential transactions in connection with our coal business today at all. I will say, though, that conversations about the composition of our portfolio and the role of carbon in the portfolio are not new, nor are they news. We've been quite public that we are looking to reduce the proportion of coal in our portfolio over time. And while we like the long-term fundamentals of the coal business, of course, we always evaluate alternatives to improve our portfolio. So with that, over to you, Fraser, to start the Q&A.
Okay, thanks, Don. Joining me for this Q&A on strategy, we have Don, of course, who will be our moderator. Riel, Red, Alex, Nick, and Jonathan also. So, Matt, over to you to open up for questions, please.
Thank you, Mr. Fraser. Please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause while the participants register for questions. Thank you for your patience. The first question is from Orest Wakoda of Scotiabank. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. Don, I appreciate your comments here a second ago about not wanting to address some of the media reports about the coal business, but maybe I could frame it a different way in that has the board determined at all what the ideal mix is from a commodity perspective and how coal fits into that? Is there potentially a target of trying to dilute the coal to, say, I don't know, sub 20% of the portfolio or anything to that matter?
Okay, well, thanks for the question, Norris, and let me congratulate you again for once more being the first question up. We've got a pretty consistent track record there. Short answer to your question is no, there's no specific threshold that's been set by the board. We looked at a whole range of alternatives, and, it continues to get intense focus, but no target as such has been set. But if you run your own models, you'll see that just with what we're doing with the bring on QB2 next year, that it'll drop, quite significantly with the doubling of the copper production.
And is that then likely to continue as you bring on some of those near-term copper growth projects, St. Nicholas, Zafranal? I mean, just looking at your sort of copper growth strategy, would appear the coal is going to be a significantly lower part of the portfolio by, call it, end of decade. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair. And I would hope that it is sooner than the end of decade because each of those projects that you mentioned can come on before 2030.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Greg Barnes of TD Securities. Please go ahead.
A couple of questions on QB2. One, peak workforce, are you there yet, or when do you expect to achieve it? And two, I just want to hear from Red and John Christopher about the strategies for ramp-up in terms of how you are going to integrate the production team from the construction team, how that handover is going to happen, and what the strategy is.
Okay, maybe the first one over to Alex and then Red for the second.
Sure, okay, thanks. Thanks, Greg. In terms of peak workforce, so we are very close to our peak workforce number. In fact, as we progress various different disciplines and as we move away from civils into other mechanical and electrical pieces, we continue to add workers and turn them over. But we will stick with this peak workforce through the fourth quarter here as we work through the various areas of the project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Lucas Pipes of B. Riley Securities. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Sorry, operator, we weren't finishing answer the previous question, so I'll just turn it back to Red on the ramp-up question, and then we'll go back to Lucas. Thank you.
Greg, so we've got a ramp-up schedule that we're executing. We're hiring and training people now. There, as Alex mentioned in his presentation, some of the work that we're doing on the tailings management facility is actually being self-performed by our mine operator personnel. So we're operating the new truck fleet. We've got additional mine equipment coming in, being assembled and running through all kinds of drills every day on startup. One of the advantages of this integrated operations center that we've put in is you can actually simulate operating the plant. So we're running through simulations with operators, with supervision. We're also taking personnel to Carmen Down to Coil, which is our other operating entity in Chile, and getting hands-on experience there. So a ramp up for operations is going on a variety of fronts right now, and we're working, you know, day in, day out on having a successful startup.
Okay, back to Lucas.
Hey, good afternoon. Good morning, everybody, and thank you very much for hosting this event. This is always great. Don, and I vaguely remember that in prior cycles of Met Coal, you commented on one of these calls, or it might have been earnings call yesterday, that you're receiving daily updates on the new Met Coal projects that are being announced and monitoring the situation very closely. Now, you fast forward a few years. I'm not seeing a lot of projects out there, but wondering if you're still getting daily updates. Maybe they're weekly now, but what is included there? Where are you seeing new Met Coal supply coming from? And obviously, as it relates to tech, I assume, given the preceding questions, there's no interest in changing things on the supply side, but I would be curious how that global supply picture could in any way affect your decision on that. Thank you very much for your perspective.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for the question, Lucas. And before I turn it over to Rael to get his comments on new supply or lack thereof, the way I would answer your question is say, well, it may not be daily, but part of that is because there isn't much being announced other than projects being turned down in both Australia and Canada and elsewhere in the market. So, I mean, Grassy Mountain's a very high-profile one here, but there have been others that have been turned down in the permitting process. So, I mean, it's tough to bring on new supply in steelmaking coal. It's tough to bring on new mines anywhere, but steelmaking coal is going to be tough to see that grow. But, Rael, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Don. Thanks, Lucas, for the question. Yeah, you're correct. I mean, there's very little new projects being announced, if any, especially so for high-grade hard coking coal. I guess you will have seen the news a while ago now that what is most significant is Anglo restarting both Moranbah North and also applying to restart the Grosvenor mine. So that is around 12 to 13 million tons of annualized production. That's what they were running at prior to the mine accidents and incidents that shut them down. Other than that, there is very little out there, either in terms of new projects or expansion. And I think, you know, it is related to the fact that capital is less attractive maybe to steelmaking coal than it was in previous cycles.
That's very helpful. Really appreciate the update, and thanks again.
Thank you. The next question is from Jackie Przybylowski of BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thanks very much. I know you mentioned this earlier in your presentation that some of your satellite assets, Zafranal and San Nicolas, are getting closer to the position where you could realize value or monetize them maybe. Can you give us a bit of an update on the timing as to when you may see an announcement on an asset sale? Like how close are you?
What I would say is it's more important to do it right and get the right partner and right structure of a deal than it is to do it quickly. So it is true that we are in discussions with potential partners, and there's a variety of routes that we could go to with these, but I don't anticipate this happening in the very near term. I'd say it's more in the medium term. If we could come to a landing on it by the end of the year, that would be great. But we're not going to rush it. We're going to try and get it right. We really, as Nick highlighted in his presentation, the model we used for QB2 with Sumitomo Metal Mining, Sumitomo Corporation, these are two fabulous partners. And the structure of the deal really worked in terms of de-risking the project financially, allowing us to continue to return capital to shareholders. We'd like to do something with those principles behind it as well, so that we enhance our growth beyond QB2, while at the same time protecting our ability to return cash to shareholders. So that's sort of a long answer without much clarity for you, but that's how it is right now.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. If I could ask one other question. You talked about Galore Creek as being one of your medium-term priorities, or medium priorities, I guess, sort of on par with QB3 and ahead of Nuevo Union, it looked like. Can you maybe give us a bit of an update on how aligned your timeline is for Galore Creek and Nuevo Union with your joint venture partner? Are you guys both seeing the same in terms of which of those two assets is the higher priority?
Well, let me start by saying that Teck and Newmont have a really strong working relationship, and we have 50-50 joint ventures, not just at Galore, but at Nuevo Union as well. But for a more specific answer, I'll turn it over to Nick Hooper.
Hi, Jackie. I would say that at the moment, the focus is very much on the Galore Creek pre-feasibility study. Work is continuing, optimization work is continuing on waiver reunion. And in terms of, so both of us are aligned on that approach.
Great. Thanks very much. That's all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Emily Chiang of Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Good morning, everyone. Just a couple follow-ups on the coal segment there. I think Teck's longer-term coal production outlook was roughly 26 to 27 million tons. With the startup of Neptune and some of the sort of infrastructure debottlenecking activities, is there potential that that number creeps a little higher?
And the short answer to that is no. The investment in Neptune expanding the port capacity was done for several key reasons, but one of the really important one was having the flexibility and freedom to deliver our coal, our product to the customers when they want it. And we had found that there were constraints to that before, and one quarter actually cost us $200 million of EBITDA in one quarter when we didn't have access to delivery that we needed. So I look at that as having more flexibility in the whole logistics system rather than giving us increased capacity to take that 26 to 27 million ton number higher. So we anticipate it staying in that range for a while yet. We're always going to review the portfolio, as I said earlier, but to the extent that we've said that we're reducing the proportion of carbon in the portfolio, it is unlikely that we would grow production out of the valley.
That's very clear. And just a quick follow-up around the QB2 $600 million of COVID capital cost estimates. Is there an estimate as to how much has been consumed so far? I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
I'll turn that back to Red for Alex.
Yeah, Emily, I have a question. We have not incurred a large sum of that. Those are all forecast at completion cost estimates, so it has to do with schedule effects and those kinds of things. So most of that remains out in front of us yet to be consumed.
Thank you. The next question is from Dalton Moretto of Canaccord Genuity. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Dalton Moretto of Canaccord Genuity, your line is open.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Sorry about that. Don, another portfolio question for you here. Just given Teck's history in terms of changing the commodity mix in the portfolio, you know, and as you look to reduce the proportion of carbon going forward, what's the board's thinking right now in terms of potentially adding new commodities to the mix, you know, things like uranium or lithium or even nickel?
You know, we look at those commodities as just part of our ongoing review of the industry. Nick has a whole team that, you know, analyzes transactions that others are doing, other opportunities that are out there, so that we are knowledgeable about them. And obviously, at different times, we've looked very closely at nickel. But at this stage right now, we don't have any particular opportunity in front of us that that we're focused on in those other commodities, but that's not to say that we wouldn't if we saw the right thing coming up.
Okay, and then just maybe a follow-up. This is on QB2, but not directly. Can you let us know what you're hearing in terms of the latest in the changing Chilean fiscal and royalty regime?
Okay, I think for that one, what I'm going to do is ask Amparo Cornejo, our Vice President in Chile, to give you the latest on that question. And Amparo, actually on our behalf, testified in front of the Senate committee that was reviewing it. So, Amparo, over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Don. Good afternoon. Good morning. Maybe the most relevant and newest information on the process is that the Senate Mining Committee has approved to legislate in relation to the mining royalty bill that was previously approved by the Chilean Chamber of Deputies. The Senate committee has spent a lot of time providing opportunity to different players to present ideas and to provide the perspective on the bill, and the mining industry was part of that. And what has happened after that is that this committee has approved the idea of legislating, and we expect that the Senate will approve that that process. The next step is that within the next couple of weeks, we are waiting and expecting to know what are going to be the indications that the committee will present. So at that moment, we will know exactly what are the changes that the Senate has introduced to the original bill that was approved by the Chamber of Deputies. So waiting that information that would provide a good context. And also, as you know, most of the mining companies in Chile have invariability tax agreements with the state of Chile. And in our case, we have those agreements both for Canmen de Andacollo and for QB2.
That's great, Color.
Thank you.
So just if I can clarify then, so in the next couple of weeks, we will hear from the Senate in terms of what changes have been made to the bill?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and is there any risk, you know, as the Constitution's being rewritten, that any of these DL-600-type stability agreements will be up for review?
No, we don't expect that the process that is taking place in relation with the Constitution will have any impact on these DL-600 agreements.
That's great. Thank you very much. That's all for me.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The next question is from Carlos de Alba of Morgan Stanley. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. So also on QB2, so just wondering, with all the inflation that we're seeing across raw materials, what is the scope for a potential increase in the $5.2 billion capex for QB2? Or in other words, like how much of the capex is still exposed to potential changes that you may have to review later on? And then if you could maybe also comment on the other sort of build or a proposal that is in Chilean Congress, which is related to the glacier and how mining projects may work with glaciers going forward. Any update there would also be very appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, Red or Alex, maybe start with Red.
Yeah, thanks, Carlos. We've purchased almost all of the material that we require to build the project, and a lot of it's already on site. The most of the spend to go is in Chilean pesos. It's mostly labor. We do have some electrical rooms that are being assembled in Santiago, but again, we have most of that material and the expense to go on those as labor. And you know, right now the exchange rate is pretty similar to what we had forecast in the numbers that we've been reporting publicly. So we don't, from a inflation standpoint, we don't see a lot of pressure that way.
Thank you. The next question is from Abhi Agarwal of Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Don and team. Really appreciate the update. I have a couple of questions, please. The first one is on your growth projects. Could you please talk about the pecking order of your projects? Which is the first project you think you would like to build?
I'll turn that one over to Nick Hooper.
Obviously, Zafranal has a pre-feasibility study on it, and we're going through the permitting process. So that by definition is a little bit further forward. How that fits into our portfolio is as Don indicated, sort of a question of much internal discussion. And then obviously after that, San Nicolas, because there's a pre-feasibility study, but we're just starting the permitting process on that. So that's probably the right order, but things can change.
Got it. Thank you. The second question I have is around the strategy around building new projects. Would you like to follow the QB2 model and partner up, or would you like to go alone, especially as the balance sheet becomes stronger post QB2 ramping up to full capacity? Thank you.
There's a couple of parts to the answer on that one. First is we really are very pleased with the model we used on QB2. We think that just makes sense. And having partners is not just a financial undertaking. It also brings, highly skilled and experienced people into the team and makes the team stronger and the likelihood of a successful project execution that much better. So I think throughout Teck's history, most of the key mines that Teck has as a portfolio has been as a partner. We have looked at things. St. Nicholas, we own 100%. We bought out the partner there at that time. It was Goldcorp. But when we look at that and then we balance the resources that we're allocating to QB2, QB3 and others, and we know that we have to just stay laser focused on executing those well, it did make sense or looked appealing to have another partner build it with their people and their capital. It keeps us then totally focused on QB2 and QB3 and preserves our ability to return cash to shareholders, just like we did with the QB2 financing. So really that's how we look at it. On Zaffirelli, I should note that we own 80% of that, so we already have a partner in that circumstance, but we'll carry on with our discussions there.
Thanks a lot, Don, and best of luck.
Sorry, Abby. Matt, it's Fraser. I think coming to the end of our allotted time for questions, we should probably move on here. So with that, thanks, Don, and thanks, team, for all those answers. We'll move on to our second panel at this point. Our second panel is on operations. Red Conger will begin with some introductory remarks. He'll be followed by Andrew Milner. Andrew is our Senior Vice President and Chief Transformation Officer. And Andrew will be joined by Greg Brower, Vice President of Transformation, and Andrea LaRue, our Director of Value Delivery for RACE 21. And they're going to discuss some of the exciting progress that's been made on RACE 21. After that will be Shahzad Barmal, our Senior Vice President, Base Metals, North America and Peru, and he'll provide an update on base metal business. And then Robin Sharametta, our Senior Vice President of Coal, with an update on our steelmaking coal business. After that, Rial is back. He'll provide an update on logistics, brief update. And then finally, Kieran McFadden, Senior Vice President of Energy, will provide an update on Fort Hills. With that, Red, over to you.
Thank you, Fraser. Our team continues to successfully manage the challenges the COVID pandemic has brought us, keeping our employees safe and protecting our communities. Our safety performance has been equally commendable. We have excellent operating teams who have done an exceptional job maintaining solid production capabilities during the tumultuous market gyrations over the last 18 months. We have completed key enabling projects this year and achieved important milestones that our panel will provide updates on. Our mines are properly stripped and developed, and our processing plants and mobile fleets are well maintained. Our business units are hitting their stride in the second half of this year as we recover nicely from wildfire disruptions in BC during July and August. This combination of execution focus, agility to respond to COVID, and rapidly changing market conditions puts us in an excellent position. We are sprinting to the end of the year on our transformational RACE 21 program. All operations in both mining and processing within our operations are logging impressive gains this year in spite of COVID-related logistics challenges. Our cost profile, production levels, and current commodity prices bode very well for the remainder of this year. These are very exciting times for our operating team at Teck. And with that, I will turn it over to Andrew Milner on RACE 21.
Thanks, Red, and good morning, everyone. We are now coming to the end of the RACE 21 program. And although we are planning to report on the full results of the program at the end of this year, we felt now was a perfect time to update you on the incredible journey we have been on. Before we do that, I want to remind everyone that RACE is Teck's digital transformation program that I announced to the market in 2019. RACE stands for Renew, Automate, Connect, and Empower, which represent the four key areas of focus for our transformation. Renew involves the organisation-wide upgrades to our infrastructure systems, LTE, sensors, and numerous other aspects of our technology and data infrastructure. Automate is a holistic approach to automation across all facets, but with an early focus on mobile equipment. Connect involves the linking of all aspects of our value chain via an integrated data platform. Empower acknowledges the most important aspect of our transformation, our people. RACE is having significant impact on our company, both in terms of value creation and on our culture. This has certainly been the most exciting initiative I've had the privilege to lead during my career. I'll now hand it over to Greg Brower, our Vice President of Transformation, leading the delivery aspects of the program, to elaborate on our exciting journey over the last 2 years.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks, Andrew. We're super excited to be here today to talk to you because it was only just over 2 years ago that Teck first embarked upon the RACE 21 digital transformation. A tremendous amount has happened since then. We have built a digital capacity and capability that we feel is second to none in our industry. Our culture has embraced digital transformation, and we have seen significant value creation. And although Race 21 started as a program, we feel the capacity and capability that we have built, we will be leveraging going forward as a core competency in our company, just like we have relied on engineering, geology, metallurgy, and other capabilities in the past. I get the opportunity to talk a lot about Race 21 and what we're achieving. And when people ask me why we are seeing the successes we are, I often point to a saying that resonated with me a few years ago, which is that if you want to achieve great outcomes as a company, you need two things, a bold goal and not quite enough time. So when we started Race 21, we really embraced that philosophy. We set a bold goal to deliver an initial $150 million in ongoing value, and we said we would achieve that goal in only 6 short months. We were very conscious early on in the program that a lot of these digital transformation programs are not successful. In fact, we have heard that upwards of 60 to 70% of them fail after a short period of time. And so at Tech, we have from the very beginning been very value-focused and impact-focused, because that is where other organizations fail. They start to focus on the cool technology, not the impact that they can have on the organization. We also recognized in the beginning that there was some healthy skepticism of what digital could do at Tech. As a company, we didn't know what it was, and we weren't entirely comfortable with the impact it could have. And it was for these reasons that we established this concept of Path to Value, or PTV, when we set the initial target of 150, and we created a culture laser-focused on impact and value creation. We started by standing up 6 domains with an early focus on mining and processing. We also knew early on that there absolutely would be value in leveraging what is referred to as advanced analytics across these domains, given what we had seen at other organizations that had gone before us. And because today we're going to talk a lot about advanced analytics, before we move on, I want to do a quick refresher of what that is. Simply put, advanced analytics involves taking a lot of data, sometimes referred to as big data, from our company and streaming it to the cloud in real time. Then using the huge computing power that is available to us from Google and Microsoft to analyze that data, to find patterns in that data, and ultimately, and this is where the value is, predict what is going to happen in the future based on what is happening in that moment, to then make a recommendation as to what we should change today to optimize value. With this technique in hand, we wanted to start off today by taking you back to how we were first thinking about one of our initial focus areas, what we called Hall Cycle Analytics. With a vision and goal in place, the team hit the ground running, and we established Tech's first Race Digital Squad. Now, these digital squads, as they're known, embrace an agile methodology, which is a customer-focused, iterative approach to digital product development, and quite different than the waterfall approach all of us here at Tech are used to using, for example, in the execution of our major capital projects. Agile focuses on rapid, continuous releases that incorporate operations feedback with every iteration. And although we have a general sense of the direction a digital product is going to go over time, we don't worry too much about planning for the ultimate endpoint at the beginning. We let the users and the process take us down the value, or down the path, rather, that represents the greatest value opportunity wherever that may take us. One of the reasons we want to talk about Hall Cycle Analytics first is that it illustrates the pattern that ultimately we would follow for nearly every single digital product we would develop over the next 2 years. We had computers on board all of our haul trucks. We had the trucks well instrumented with sensors, generating an enormous amount of data, and we had Wi-Fi networks in our minds to send that data to the cloud in real time. We just were not effectively using that data. And if you recall from a couple of minutes ago when I described advanced analytics, then hopefully you can see why this Hall Cycle space was so attractive to us. So with the start of Race, we began asking ourselves, what can we do with this data? And that was the inspiration for Hall Cycle Analytics, one of the first products we developed. The team's initial diagnostics provided insights into significant opportunity to improve haulage productivity across the company that we just couldn't see before. They selected a couple of problems that needed to be solved to drive up truck productivity and rapidly developed and deployed initial products. As the team established its footing and ways of working, they then quickly expanded the scope to end-to-end haulage optimization, delivering an integrated suite of digital tools that were first piloted at our Fording River operation and subsequently have been scaled across all coal sites and HVC. It was rudimentary at first, but it had impact.
What excites me about Race 21? Well, it has been the opportunity to push boundaries and unlock productivity benefits in areas we didn't think were possible. Fording River is a truck-constrained operation that for many years has continued to see cost pressures due to our deepening pits, increasing hauls, and higher strip ratios. Considering the importance of truck productivity to maintain competitiveness and profitability, we leaned heavily on the race team to help the site find another step change in performance. The big stretch goal for Fording was to achieve productivities the site has never seen by bettering system optimization and improving travel time and fixed time components. As Race started to build capacity and add new capability, we soon realized we could gain access to new insights about our operation that we couldn't see before. These new insights have allowed our frontline leaders to make better and faster decisions to improve operational results. Road Quality App is an example of how analytics has helped our frontline leaders make better decisions around fixing roads and allocating resources, something they've historically struggled with. Another great example has been the development and deployment of an advanced machine learning and optimization algorithm called truck allocation, which maximizes material movement while reducing overall system inefficiencies, such as truck queuing. Using this tool in conjunction with our current fleet management system has allowed Fording River to achieve truck queuing times below 1 minute, something I never thought possible. I'm super excited to continue to work with the enormously capable race teams and find and unlock the next level of performance for Fording River and for Tech.
Most critically, these early wins gave the race team and ultimately Tech's leadership the confidence and experience that enabled the rapid expansion into other domains, including processing. Like our truck fleets, Tech's wash plants and concentrators are data rich. Thousands of process variables, pump speeds, flow rates, etc., are recorded every second, the perfect start for advanced analytics. Advanced analytics uses this historical data to understand which control room operator decision in the past resulted in the best outcome. And using that information, we can build digital advisory systems that help us make the best decision every time going forward. Now, some of the operators were initially skeptical, but were willing to take the lead. Their confidence grew in 2019 when we developed our first minimum viable product, or MVP as we call them, for the HVC flotation circuit, and we saw immediate success. Another area of the company that saw the potential early on was Red Dog, and like HVC, they very aggressively embraced that opportunity, installing significant instrumentation over a very short period of time at the end of 2019 that allowed Red Dog to start stabilizing and optimizing their circuit to an extent they had never been able to before. In the end, Red Dog and HVC concentrators were two of the greatest contributors to value creation in 2019. Which brings us to the end of 2019. In less than 6 months, we met our goal, and well over $150 million of direct, annualized, and ongoing value started to flow. Achievement of this milestone did three things for us. First, we really gained the critical buy-in from leadership and operations as to what digital was and what it could deliver. Second, we generated an energy and excitement across the organization. And third, this success was the catalyst that supercharged our culture shift, changing mindsets about what is possible at Tech through digital. We want to tell you now what has happened over the year and a half since that initial success. But before we do that, we want to talk about a very critical element that needed to be in place for all of this to happen. Everything we talk about here today only happens if one thing exists, and that's data. Data, getting to the cloud as fast as possible, getting the sensors installed, the data pipelines built. Without this foundational work done by Tech's Digital Systems Group, none of Race would have been possible and none of the value would have been there. The excitement of achieving the PTV or Path to Value 150 milestone and supported by the rapid advancement of the foundational technology investments that we were making propelled us into 2020. As I said earlier, one of the reasons we were seeing success is because we decided early on that we needed to be very value-focused as a program. Core to establishing that culture was creating a team within Race 21 we called Value Delivery. Now, this is a team that's actually quite unique to Tech. It doesn't typically exist in digital transformation programs, but we felt it was key to driving impact. The best way to think about Value Delivery is that they are the integrators between our digital teams and talent and our sites. They deeply understand both operations and digital, so they act as a bridge. Today, Andrea LaRue leads that value delivery team. So at this point, I'm going to hand over to her to describe how things evolve with Race in 2020 and 2021. Andrea, over to you.
Thanks, Greg. The role of value delivery in the Race 21 program is really exciting. It's our team's job to collaborate with operations, to understand and interpret the business needs, and to bring together diverse teams to solve really complex problems. And while value and impact can be measured in terms of reduced cost, increased production, or ultimately free cash flow, there are impacts that are harder to quantify, but equally important to sustaining long-term value. So yes, tech is building some really impactful technology, but above all else, Race is a people and culture transformation program. It's about changing the way we look at our business, the way we use data to solve problems, the way we empower people at all levels of the organization to make important business decisions every day. In the very early stages of Race, there wasn't a great understanding of what Race was really about. The program was well received in 2019, but there was that natural skepticism, and so the Race team was doing more of the pushing. But that all changed in 2020, as the broader organization's understanding and appreciation for the power of digital tools grew. And it was in early 2020 when the team first started to see that impact was occurring, that the culture was changing. A great example of leadership's growing appreciation for the power of advanced analytics was when in the spring of 2020, Robin approached the Race team and asked a really pivotal question. He said, "We have the teams in place and all this data related to our haul truck movements and operator behaviors. How can we leverage these teams and this data to reduce the risk of vehicle interactions on our sites?" Race pulled the team together in a week, partnered with people from the coal business unit and corporate offices, and through ideation, diagnostics, and road mapping, the team came up with Race's first digital safety tools. Too often when we have incidents and investigate causes, we learn that the key contributing factors are behavioral. People are not making good decisions, they're becoming complacent or not following protocols. So when it comes to heavy and light vehicle interactions, we've created almost complete transparency into how our people are operating haul trucks and vehicles on our sites. Through digital scorecards and safety alerts, we've enabled supervisors and trainers to have the right conversations with the right people at the right time. We're changing behaviors so that all of our people can go home safe and healthy every day. As our first iterations of digital safety tools were emerging, our haul cycle analytics team was, by mid-2020, well-established, and the impact of haul cycle analytics on truck productivity was evident. Our coal business unit had already been on a journey of improving truck productivity, and by mid-2020, the digital tools that were first developed and piloted in partnership with Fording River Operations, as we heard from Richard Whittington a few minutes ago, had now been scaled across all of Teck Coal, providing our mining teams across the business unit with access to insights that they just didn't have in the past. Through this partnership, Teck Coal's standard haulage model continued to rise to over 105%. This represented record truck productivity across the business unit. The processing analytics team also made great advancements in 2020. Tools like the mill and flotation optimizers leverage years of data combined with predictive analytics to optimize set points for pump speeds, flow rates, chemical levels, et cetera, resulting in reduced variability, increased throughput and recovery, and overall improved concentrator performance. Highland Valley Copper was the first adopter of these models, and by 2020, these tools had been deployed to every base metals concentrator and coal wash plant across Teck, with the exception only of LQ, which in 2020 was progressing the 9M plant upgrades. In 2019, feedback features on the apps collected comments from operators that indicated a hesitation to trust the tools. Operators were clearly skeptical, but by the end of 2020, the operators were bought in. They're now the first ones to escalate if the application is down. They want those applications available 24/7 as a critical tool in the way they work. The development of these products would not have been possible without the strong support from all of the operations team. That said, one of the greatest influences driving team collaboration, adoption, and ultimately results is strong leadership support. One of the things we learned early on from other organizations that have attempted digital transformation was the criticality of senior leadership engagement. The leadership from Shahzad and Robin has been outstanding. So a lot of the successes we're highlighting today have really been enabled by the top-down leadership support we've experienced. Through the initial months of RACE, we intentionally focused on mining and processing because we knew there was significant value creation potential in those areas. And in doing that, we learned just how broadly applicable advanced analytics was to addressing bottlenecks and operational challenges. In a similar situation in the sustainability space, we have ambitious goals, complex challenges, and a lot of data. We can use the same thinking and tools and techniques to help us in our decision-making around sustainability. Standing up the sustainability domain and targeting the coal regional water quality model is an extremely significant milestone in our journey. It's a critical example of how we can aim Teck's new internal capability to solve some of our most complex and dynamic challenges. How we can approach a problem not with a solution, but with the acknowledgement that we don't know what we don't know, and dig in to learn and to improve, so that future business decisions, such as where to place our stockpiles or where we should be treating water in the future, are informed by the most up-to-date information and most powerful advanced analytics tools available. So now that we've shared a few highlights of what we did as we scaled in 2020, I want to take a step back and talk to you about that internal capacity that we built over the last 2 years. Our digital teams are made up of people with diverse roles, backgrounds, and experience levels that need to be organized in a specific way to be able to build these digital tools that, in many cases, are leading-edge technologies. Our digital squads include developers, data scientists, data engineers, user experience designers, and others. Tech now has this in-house capability and these established ways of working that enable rapid product development and deployment. And our digital team members are building strong relationships with operations teams so that overall, our organizational digital literacy is increasing from the boots-on-the-ground operators to our senior management team. So let's rejoin the storyline in 2021. And as a reminder, the program originally started with focused, bespoke products, but we knew all along that eventually these products would start linking together, integrating across the value chain. And by 2021, the focus on integrated operations was growing. A significant achievement in the integrated operations domain was the development and implementation of supply chain reliability tools. For a long time, we relied on our people to be able to understand and interpret significant volumes of complex information in order to make the best decisions for the company. But given the complexity of the supply chain, it's always been extremely difficult for anyone to know exactly what the optimal solution is. And that's why this is such a game changer. Because when we take all that data and bring in predictive analytics, the computer can understand all the permutations and options that we have, and it can help teams across coal and logistics make the optimal decision every single time. We've developed a suite of tools to support our coal logistics team over the past 6 months, and we're seeing really great results from these tools, with some key performance indicators already exceeding targets. This effort's not complete. We will continue to develop, mature, and enhance these tools in partnership with the business, and we remain very excited and optimistic on the value this will unlock for the company. This takes us up to today, and I'll hand it back to you here, Greg.
Thanks, Andrea. Hopefully from our overview today, you have started to get a sense of how impactful RACE has been to Teck and the incredible value it is now unlocking. To finish off, we want to share a summary of the breadth of that impact. Today at Teck, there are over 450 RACE initiatives that are underway, supported by over 100 digital products across six domains. We have a team of approximately 40 digital squads that are actively working with sites on those products. We are seeing broad value creation across the company. And finally, and most importantly for me, we are seeing our culture change. Our organization today is recognizing where digital can create value, and we are rapidly bringing new tools to help solve our most complex business problems and optimize in a way we have never been able to before. Thank you, everyone, and I'll now turn it over to Shehzad.
Thank you, Greg. Starting on slide 2, we are very excited about the near-term growth in our base metals business, which will build on our quality copper and zinc asset base and our continued focus on operating discipline and improvement. QB2, which is expected to start production in the second half of 2022, will double our consolidated copper production by 2023, and it is expected to be a low-cost operation, providing substantial cash flow for decades. To illustrate the EBITDA potential of our base metals business once QB2 is operational, we are using the construct that Jonathan Price presented previously, isolated for the copper and zinc business units only, with QB2 EBITDA based on 290,000 tons of annual production and a C1 cost of US$28 per pound. At a copper price of $3.50 US per pound, this calculation gives us an illustrative EBITDA from base metals alone of $3.8 billion. And we can consider the substantial upside of what this looks like at current spot prices. Again, as Jonathan mentioned, this is not guidance, but provides an illustrative scenario. At our current operations, our RACE 21 program is a core part of driving significant improvements and achieving a high-performance operating culture. We have made exciting progress and improvements, and I will highlight a couple of examples shortly. Sites 3 and 4 show that our growing base metals business compares favorably to our peers, providing high production and earnings growth within the next 2 years. Our copper equivalent production is expected to be more than 850,000 tons in 2023, following the completion of QB2. I should note that the projected 2023 production figures for Teck and peers are based on Wood Mackenzie information. We have substantial high-quality resources, and these are located in very attractive mineral districts and stable jurisdictions with operations in Canada, the U.S., Chile, and Peru. This provides a balanced distribution of exposure across countries and an ability to allocate capital where risk-adjusted returns are highest. On slide 4, if you benchmark a base metals business across leading copper and base metals peers, which we encourage you to do so, you will find we have industry-leading growth, comparable production rates, and attractive unit costs. The yellow dash marks represent attributable copper equivalent production. Our size and cost position highlight that earnings generation potential within the base metals business alone would rival peer companies in both estimated earnings metrics and, very importantly, in relative value comparisons. As a result of this, we are very well positioned to benefit from the expected strong demand for metals and minerals driven by decarbonization and population growth. Looking at slide 5, our copper portfolio is based on a foundation of stable, low-cost operations, which include Antamina, Highland Valley Copper, and Carmen de Andacollo in Chile. The graph on the upper right shows that Teck's copper operations have consistently achieved gross margins before D&A between 45 to 55% over the last 5 years, and a margin of over 60% in the first half of 2021 as we benefit from rising copper prices. QB2 should further strengthen our portfolio with strong operating performance due to a low strip ratio and expected second quartile all-in sustaining costs. Beyond the startup of QB2, Teck is positioned to continue realizing value from a robust pipeline of high-potential copper opportunities that Nick highlighted, including both greenfield and brownfield projects. These opportunities continue to be refined through prudent advancement of both growth and extension options. It is important to note that these growth options are a result of intentional focus on developing this pipeline over a sustained period of time. And hence, Teck today has one of the best copper growth portfolios in the business. Now, turning to our world-class zinc business on slide six, we have high-quality assets with first quartile cost position at Red Dog and recycling capabilities at Trail to support the growing circular economy. Teck has a unique position within the zinc market. As the largest net zinc miner, we are able to maximize market value from our products through effective and strategic integration of our mining and refining operations. Looking to the future, Red Dog remains a premier zinc district with high-quality mine life extension potential at Actigaruq and Anarraq deposits. In the graph on the lower right, the bar height is the size of the deposit, and the yellow marker is the estimated grade. As you can see, our Actigaruq exploration target, which is located just 12 kilometers from Red Dog operations, and Tina in Australia, have excellent grades when compared to other undeveloped zinc assets. Moving to Race 21, since 2019, we have implemented numerous digital tools using advanced analytics at our operations that have resulted in significant improvements. On slide seven, I will highlight two specific examples of different approaches and tools currently used within our concentrator operations at Red Dog and Highland Valley that Andrea and Greg mentioned. I'll go into a little bit more detail. At Red Dog, there have been historical challenges in pushing the grinding process beyond certain rates, as in many cases, this led to process instability, creating a negative impact on recoveries for lead and zinc, and thereby eroding value. Through a focused effort leveraging advanced process control upgrades and significantly improved instrumentation, the control system optimizes the important variables in the grinding process, mill speed, water addition, ball charge, power, while adhering to safe operating constraints and preventing liner damage. The supercharged control system allows the optimization across three primary grinding mills to achieve increased combined throughput. And of course, the operators are fundamental to the success of such initiatives. The system is fully integrated with their interface, shown on the bottom right, and they have driven a 9% improvement in throughput at Red Dog. And work continues today to further improve on the achievements to date. The second example focuses on machine learning and advanced analytics at Highland Valley, where we focus on the flotation circuit. Within the flotation circuit where copper is separated from waste, there are hundreds of variables that can have an impact on the overall performance of the process, including fragmentation, ore types, and operator decisions. Operations teams typically rely on past experience to establish set points within the process. This does create challenges due to information gaps, but also from the complexity of the process, and hence the lack of ability to readily determine the optimal settings. Site teams and Race 21 have developed machine learning models that have provided our operators with real-time data and operating recommendations in real time. These recommendations are based on numerous input variables that would have been very difficult to leverage together in the past. The image on the top right shows the 40-plus set points for the frontline operators and the recommended changes from the model shown in the red boxes. The acceptance rate of the recommendations remains high today and continues to improve as the models improve with more data over time. The improvement within the flotation process is one of the key initiatives that has contributed to a 7% increase in throughput and 2% improvement of recovery, of copper recovery at Highland Valley. And please keep in mind that these are just two specific high-impact examples, and we continue to expand the applications within all our processing plants. And as Greg described earlier, similar work is ongoing in mining operations, including haul cycle analytics, as well as other projects to improve safety and environmental performance. In summary, on slide 8, the expansion of our base metals business is underway, and we are very, very well positioned to benefit from increased demand for copper and zinc, which are fundamental to the decarbonization efforts globally. We have high-quality copper assets, a world-class zinc business, and continue to drive an operating culture focused on discipline and improvements. With that, I will turn it over to Robin Sheremeta to discuss our steelmaking coal business.
Okay, thank you, Shahzad, and good afternoon, everyone. If you can just go to slide 2, I'm going to begin with a brief summary of the historical financial performance of steelmaking coal. Teck's a large, proven, and reliable supplier of high-quality steelmaking coal. Our steelmaking coal business units delivered exceptional results over the past 12 years, with an average impairment-adjusted EBITDA margin of 49% and average annual impairment-adjusted EBITDA of $2.2 billion. We have an extensive resource base in southeastern British Columbia. Our integrated operations are supported by a dedicated logistics system, providing numerous value-accretive production scenarios to meet the demand of our diversified long-term customer base. We operate 4 fully integrated mines with a long-term stable strip ratio of approximately 10 to 1, and our long-term production rate is about 26 to 27 million tons per year. With a history of over 50 years of continuous operations, we have a positive social license with a stable and highly skilled workforce and strong relationships with our unions and local communities. We're continuously driving innovation through integrating technology, optimizing coordination of our activities from planning to execution and from pit to port, all of which is underpinned by strong culture of safety performance. If you can go to the next slide. This describes our operating strategy. Our four areas of focus are optimizing our supply chain, increasing margins, drive best-in-class productivity and asset utilization through continued innovation, and maintain and enhance our commitment to strong social and environmental performance. As you can see on the map on the right side of slide 3 here, our 4 steelmaking coal operations are located within 60 kilometers of each other in the Elk Valley of southeastern British Columbia. This geographical concentration enables full operational integration to maximize planning and execution synergies to optimize the supply chain, improve market access, and provide reliability and certainty for our customers. We have total proven and probable reserves of about 800 million tons, all of which supports a long-term production run rate of about that 26 to 27 million. We did make the strategic decision to close our Cardinal River operations in 2020, and we replaced that with higher cost, replacing this higher cost production with lower cost tons through the Elkview plant expansion. The focus of our strategy in steelmaking coal is not to increase volumes, as Don said, but to increase margins and our overall competitiveness. We aim to maximize and sustain strong cash flows through managing costs and sustaining improved productivity supported by our digital transformation and innovation program, RACE 21. As you've heard quite a bit now, RACE is driving operational improvements and helping to lower our unit costs. In fact, our haul truck productivity has increased over 28% from 2012 to 2020, with 2020 being a record year. Importantly, we're committed to a strong social and environmental performance. We continue to build on our strong relationships with local communities and Indigenous peoples, and we're aggressively pursuing decarbonization initiatives and are executing on the Elk Valley Water Quality Plan. Next slide, please. Briefly, for those that might not be familiar, there's been over 100 years of mining in the Elk Valley. This has created a substantial legacy challenge associated with the large volume of waste rock that has accumulated over decades. That rock contains naturally occurring substances such as selenium, an element that is essential for human and animal health in small amounts. When water flows through this rock, it carries selenium and other substances into the watershed, and if present in high enough concentrations, these substances can adversely affect aquatic health. In 2014, the Elk Valley Water Quality Plan was developed to address this challenge, and it was approved by the BC Ministry of Environment. It established short, medium, and long-term water quality targets to maintain the health of the watershed. And this year marks a major milestone in the plan, as after years of work, we are commissioning a substantial volume of water treatment that will materially improve water quality. We currently treat some of the water in active water treatment facilities, which uses a tank-based biological treatment process. Going forward, we expect to treat water using saturated rock fills, or SRFs, and this is where old mining areas are backfilled with rock, saturated with water to remove selenium and nitrate using a naturally occurring bacteria. You may recall our team researched and developed SRFs, which are less costly and a more effective form of water treatment. In February, we successfully commissioned our first one, the Elkview SRF, which was under budget and ahead of schedule, and it's now delivering about 20 million liters per day of treatment capacity and achieving near complete removal of selenium and nitrate. Between it and Lion Creek's active water treatment facility, we're now treating up to 27.5 million liters of water per day. I'm also pleased to tell you that the Fording River Active Water Treatment Facility is now completed and it's being commissioned. It will add a further 20 million liters per day capacity. We also expect to complete phase one of our second SRF facility at Fording River this fall, allowing us to treat an additional 7 million liters of water per day. And next year, we'll expand that facility to 30 million liters of water per day. So to recap, we started the year with 17.5 million liters of treatment capacity, and we'll finish 2021 with a capacity of more than 50 million liters, or triple the treatment capacity of today. And this will grow to 70 million liters next year. We've included a summary of our guidance for capital and operating costs related to water treatment in the appendix. In summary, after years of work, we expect to see a material improvement in water quality throughout the watershed. Turning to slide five, our steelmaking coal business is well positioned to achieve carbon neutrality. We're committed to improve energy efficiency and reduce emissions. We're currently developing a carbon reduction technology roadmap in support of Teck's commitment to be carbon neutral across all of our operations by 2050. Notably, the greenhouse gas intensity for Teck's steelmaking coal production is amongst the lowest in the industry, as shown by the graph on the right, which includes Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions from our operations. Our high-quality steelmaking coal contributes to cleaner steel production due to the high coke strength of our products, which helps ensure stable and efficient blast furnace operations and results in lower carbon dioxide emissions per ton of steel. A significant advantage of our operations in BC is the electricity is provided through hydroelectric power, which is obviously a low carbon source. We continue to evaluate renewable and alternative energy sources and introduce efficient and emissions-free fleet technology. And Marcia will be speaking to our carbon neutrality objectives shortly. Turning to slide six, just wanted to summarize the operating philosophy in steelmaking coal. It's critically important to understand the relationship between operating costs and coal pricing. Our objective is to maximize cash flow in any market. So when the price of coal is high, we aim to maximize production in order to drive cash flow and EBITDA generation. While costs remain a key focus, we may choose to strategically spend to generate additional production and increase margins to meet market demand. Under this scenario, we'll often use higher cost equipment where necessary. We'll utilize contractor labor to ensure we have high availabilities in our plants and with the equipment. We may increase overtime, and we'll look at strategies like inter-site processing. We invest in reducing risk to production, and we take steps to mitigate potential issues. A good example of this, we just recently supplemented the Fording River haulage fleet with low-cost used truck capacity to maximize raw coal availability from the mine going forward. In a low coal price environment, our focus shifts to cost reductions and deferrals to deliver, again, maximum cash flow for our shareholders. We demonstrated our ability to do this effectively in the downturn of 2013 to 2016, and through this period, we implemented a hiring freeze, reduced contractors, and idled our high-cost equipment. And as a result, we were able to deliver strong cash flows despite a very challenging environment through that period. This recent period of very high premium pricing to China is unique in our history. Our target of 7.5 million tons, or 30% of our sales to the Chinese market this year, reflects our margin strategy for high-price environments and our operational flexibility. Our steelmaking coal business has demonstrated we can quickly respond to any market condition and deliver strong returns by focusing on the levers that maximize cash flows and value for our shareholders while meeting our customer commitments.
Slide 7 illustrates that our operating margins are competitive relative to industry peers, as shown in the chart on the lower right. Our Neptune Port upgrade project is complete. Rial will speak to the project in our logistics chain in a moment. The Neptune upgrade secures a long-term, low-cost, reliable steelmaking coal port access for our supply chain for the long term. Our logistics costs are lower through Neptune than through West Shore Terminal or Ridley Terminal. With a lower cost base and strengthened supply chain, our steelmaking coal business is well-positioned for the future. And as you've heard quite a bit of, our race transformation is ongoing. There are numerous initiatives in mine operations, maintenance, and processing underway and implemented. Due to the innovative nature of these projects, some will generate strong upside, while others may prove out, may not prove out or require more time than anticipated to achieve target objectives. However, on balance, we're seeing our unit cost inflation and COVID-19-related productivity impacts have been notably mitigated by our RACE 21 initiatives compared to our peers through this year. Our cost and production profiles are predictable and stable as our long-term strip ratio remains constant. We continue to achieve best-in-class truck productivity and asset utilization levels. And further, we expect the gap between our cost and that of our primary competitor is going to widen because they are guiding for a cost increase of over 20%, and our costs are expected to remain relatively stable. Finally, as mentioned earlier, we've got a diversified long-term customer base and integrated operations, including a dedicated logistics system. This supports our extensive resource base, providing numerous value accretive production scenarios to meet market demand and deliver strong returns in any price environment. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rial to provide an update on our logistics chain supply.
All right. Thank you, Robin. Starting on slide 2, the coal logistics chain is performing really well, actually the best it ever has, showing the benefits of port and rail optionality and related resilience. The sound commercial arrangements with rail and ports and the increased capacity as Neptune ramps up improve the reliability of the coal supply chain. For instance, we moved over 350,000 tons through Ridley terminals during Vancouver rail closure caused by the unfortunate BC wildfires. And that movement through Ridley terminals helped us to partially mitigate impact to sales and mine production. The Kamloops rail interchange between CN and CP is performing well, moving product to the port efficiently. Mine inventory is at good levels, providing options for loading trains and flexibility at the mines. As Andrea highlighted earlier, RACE 21 technology is also assisting the coal supply chain continuous improvement, supporting coordination between mines, rail, ports, and vessels, and reinforcing the efficient and optimal utilization of capacity. Neptune is performing well with equipment demonstrating design capacities, with over 300 trains dumped and over 60 vessels loaded since April this year. Terminal-wide system integration and ramp-up is going as planned and targeting over 18.5 million tons annualized rate in Q4. We thought we'd share a few photos of Neptune on the following slides. Next slide, please. So Neptune is a world-class terminal with modern control rooms for remote vessel loading and train dumping, state-of-the-art visibility and collision avoidance systems ensure safe and efficient operation. Next slide, please. First coal was put through the tandem dumper on April 19, as previously reported. This is what you see on the photo here, the actual tandem dumper in action. The train dumping is performing well with the new tandem dumper and the upgraded single dumper. Next slide, please. Neptune's yard system includes new stacker, reclaimer, and conveyors, allowing efficient train unloading and vessel loading. Next slide, please. This is the new high-capacity West ship loader. And on the next slide, this is a view of Neptune's two ship loaders in action, loading the largest vessel ever for the terminal, and also showing the benefits of the Neptune upgrade. The high-capacity West ship loader is at the top of the photo, and the upgraded East ship loader is in the foreground. And with that, I will turn it over to Kieran McFadyen on energy.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. So my aim today is to provide a Fort Mills update and brief outlook. I do want to emphasize right up front that our absolute short-term focus is on ramping up Fort Hills and maximizing asset utilization. Well, let me start with a short recap on Fort Hills, the asset. Next slide, please. Fort Hills is a long-life, high-quality asset, both in terms of its scale and ore quality. And in terms of scale, at nameplate capacity of 194,000 barrels a day, the asset provides stable free cash flow for over 30 years. It operates in a stable jurisdiction with a high-quality workforce and high-quality supply chains generally. And I do want to stress that from a greenhouse gas point of view, Fort Hills production is one of the lowest in oil sands. So to summarise, Fort Hills is a long-life, low-cost, high-quality asset located in a progressive jurisdiction. Next slide, please. So I want to begin by saying that the operator's done a commendable job managing COVID. There have been no significant business impacts as a result of COVID. Now, in our Q2 2021 news release, we reference several operational issues at Fort Hills related to contract overburden stripping, groundwater inflow, and mine slope instability. And I want to note that none of these issues are long-term structural issues and will not have any impact on 2022 operating plans. The operator is absolutely focused on overburden stripping to expose sufficient ore to maintain and indeed sustain production at full rates. Overall, we're seeing clear signs of improvements in mine productivity with the recent operational performance, and we're well positioned to ramp up production heading into 2022 with a clear focus on maximising asset utilisation, as I said. On the cost side, the operator has been actively working to understand how the partnership can further reduce costs, and the partners are working together in a constructive manner to support these efforts. And clearly, as production ramps up, it also provides an opportunity for us to improve our cost structure overall from a unit cost point of view. Next slide, please. So as we stabilise production, we expect to see a significant improvement in Fort Hills EBITDA. And as you can see in the chart on the right, the EBITDA has the potential to increase by over $500 million. This assumes production at nameplate capacity and operating costs that actually we have achieved already. But please note that in December 2018, we produced over 200,000 barrels a day, well above nameplate, and the operating costs below $23 per barrel Canadian. So this, in part, gives us the confidence in the financial potential of the Fort Hills asset. Importantly, this confidence is further underpinned by recent improvements in global benchmark energy prices. We're also seeing steady Canadian differentials, which are forecasted to improve further, with Enbridge Line 3 expansion expected to be in service early in Q4. In fact, we expect to see it coming online next month. Added to that, we expect to see Trans Mountain TMX expansion to come in service late 2022-23. Next slide, please. As noted in previous analyst presentations, we we have not lost sight of significant debottlenecking opportunities at Fort Hills. We believe there's something in the range of 20 to 40,000 barrels per day debottlenecking opportunities at Fort Hills. But we also recognise that we first need to run the asset at full rates for 12 to 18 months to fully understand and validate the constraints. However, we do believe that there are opportunities with upside EBITDA potential. This is best illustrated in the chart on the right, with the incremental EBITDA potential of $100 to $150 million. Moreover, there may be regional synergies that could provide further and significant cost improvement opportunities. Finally, and crucially, once built and commissioned, assets like Fort Hills provide steady cash flow for decades. And with that, I'll pass back to Fraser.
That's great. Thanks, Kieran, very much. We'll now take questions on operations. Joining me for this panel is Don, of course, going to come back and moderate for us. And then Red, Andrew, Shahzad, Robin, Rial, and Kieran. As a reminder to analysts and investors, if you want to ask a question, please dial into the conference. And we'll limit questions to one if we can and make sure we fit everybody in. Otherwise, Matt, over to you to start the questions.
Thank you, sir. And once again, please press star one on your device's keypad if you have a question. The first question is from Carlos de Alba of Morgan Stanley. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. So when is there a time frame where perhaps you could reach the potential at Fort Hills? And how much, for lack of a better word, maybe patience would the board have with this operation before maybe taking other steps?
That one goes back to Kieran, please. I'll do the second part of it.
Sure, Don. So thanks for the question, Carlos. You know, as I mentioned in my commentary, our focus right now with the operator is to ensure that we get plans in place for the safe and efficient ramp-up. We hope to start ramp-up before the end of the year. The current plan sees a full ramp-up in Q1, so that's early January, February. But we are working hard with the operator to bring it up to full capacity and read that as something like 175,000 barrels a day, sometime early next year, January.
Okay, and just on your second question, I mean, I can say the board is certainly frustrated, management team's frustrated, and I'm sure Suncor's frustrated as well. We would like to see this back at full production because what that does to the numbers is very positive for a company. But think about this. There's real pressure on Suncor because if we're losing over $500 million in EBITDA, they're losing about $1.3 billion in EBITDA. So they have real incentive to get it up to capacity, as do we. We've had a very good dialogue with them. We work very well with them, sharing ideas and best practices and so on. But in the end of the day, they're the operator, and the real pressure is on them right now.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Dalton Barreto of Canaccord Genuity. Please go ahead.
Thanks. I'm just wondering if I can where we stand in terms of the HVC 2040 and the Antamina EVA 2 project. Thanks.
Okay, Shahzad, over to you.
Thanks. For HVC 2040, we are completing our feasibility study right now and expect to submit an EIA, and our focus really is on the EIA, getting that in the process and getting it approved, and we do expect to submit that in the second half of 2022, and a 12 to 15-month approval timeline, so that would be typical, and then there would be a time for a sanction decision at that time. With Antamina EVA, our mine life right now is till 2028, and we have been working on a MEIA to be submitted in 2022. and expect approval in 2023 to extend that mine life till 2036. And also work is ongoing on other tailings facilities to look for that to get mine life extended past 2036.
Okay, great. And just maybe switching gears to the Actigra deposit. I remember when we were on site a couple of years ago, there was talk around doing a deal with NANA. I'm just wondering if that's still in the works.
NANA has been a strong partner with us for a long period of time. And remember, the Red Dog facility is, and the ore body is on NANA lands, whereas the Actigaric and Anorak are on state lands. So there's a different regime for that, and we are working collaboratively with NANA to get alignment. We don't have a signed agreement at this point, but that work is going on very collaboratively as we develop the resource in the short term.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Brian MacArthur of Raymond James. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Sorry, my question sort of bridges back to the first part as well, but there was a slide in the first presentation where you showed potential cash flows with QB2, and there were a lot of assumptions. My two questions are the following. You talked about how you adjusted the coal business for $199, I think, coal price, but you annualized the first half of this year's EBITDA. Does that mean we didn't put the benefit going forward in those numbers of the new logistics system? And secondly, I mean, did costs get adjusted given you're assuming a higher price in the first half? How did you actually address that? And my second part of this is very simple. Similarly, if I understand the assumptions, we used the first half of oil and gas again, but that obviously wasn't particularly good this year. Did we adjust the oil and gas forecasts and those consolidated numbers for, you know, everything you've been talking about in oil and gas here, if you get back to the potential of running it all out? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, Brian, for the question. The person to answer that would be Jonathan Price, our CFO. This being the operating section of the IRD today, we didn't necessarily have him on standby. I'm just looking at the list to see if he is available. But if not, at the end of the day, we'll have a catch-all for remaining questions outstanding, and he could answer it then. So does anyone see Jonathan on the list? I don't. So,
John, I'm here.
You want to come? Okay. Yep, go ahead.
So on the second question, we hadn't assumed all of the operating benefits that Kieran was talking to. We simply took the first half performance and carried that forward with the adjustments noted. We also didn't assume the full benefit of the Neptune facility in those future forecasts as well, because we wanted to stick to the H1 performance. You can see, therefore, that there's still some upside in the numbers that we quoted. There's a bit of detail behind that, and we're happy to take that offline with Fraser and team if you want to understand that further.
No, sorry, that's very helpful, and I apologize for asking this now. I'm just on a line, so I couldn't see who was actually available. So I apologize for asking it now. I just didn't get it in last time. But thanks very much. That's very helpful. I'm just trying to.
No problem. Okay, next question.
Thank you. The next question is from Matthew Murphy of Barclays. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Thanks. There's a bunch of the Race 21 team on here, so I guess I'll take advantage of your presence to ask a question on it. I'm interested to hear a little bit of a sneak preview about what happens after 2021. I guess if 2021 was the acceleration phase, what's the constraint going forward? Is it capital? Is it people? Or, you know, is it all systems go already here? And also interested if Greg Conger has any thoughts, having come into the program in mid progress.
Okay, well, we'll let Andrew answer the first part and then turn it over to Red. I will say, though, that when we look at these things, the Race 21 just becomes a race, and it's like an
ongoing cultural transformation, as I think you saw in the presentation. But Andrew, back to you.
Yeah, look, on the future, we see a similar trajectory going forward in terms of pace and value uplift. If anything, there's potential there to ramp up, and that's something we're looking at the moment, and clearly we'll have to align decisions around that with capital constraints and other things. But one thing I would say, the initiatives we pursue in the RACE program have very short payback, and we have a rigorous approval process for each project we undertake. You saw on the slides, you know, 450-plus initiatives. All of those have a rigorous review process that we undertake, and it's approved at the highest levels. It's reviewed by myself, and if it's an initiative in base metals or in coal, and Robin or Shazad will be involved. We sit down, we discuss the merits of the initiative, and in a lot of cases, the IRRs on those is extraordinary, you know, over 200-300%, and short payback, as I say. So we're going to continue approaching the program on that basis. We have a large portfolio that we're continuing to expand. You would have heard about the domains that we talked about. We're expanding those domains. We're expanding the initiatives. And we're moving into other areas. There's an exciting future, from my perspective, in what RACE can do with our decarbonisation goals. I mentioned on the Connect piece, the integrated platform. I mean, ultimately, what we want to be able to do is look at our full value chain, and it's about reducing variability across the value chain while leveraging data, et cetera. And that's all work that's underway and will continue to reap huge benefits in the future. So, you know, that's going to be something we decide. The focus at the moment is clearly on getting to the end of this year. You know, we've made some ambitious, we've set some ambitious targets around where we want to be at the end of this year, and I'm focusing the teams on getting to the end of the year, but certainly there's a team also focusing on the future and what 2022 and beyond looks like. So stay tuned. I'm looking forward to announcing some of that in future calls. With that, Reid, I'll hand over to yourself for the next part of the question.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Matthew. There are things in the concentrator that Shazad pointed out to us that I have experience with, that I'm familiar with. So I think what Tech's doing is cutting edge there, and obviously delivering big results for us. The things that I've learned about in the past year that I was not familiar with prior, a myriad of other tools that Andrew and the team have developed. You saw some of them showcased here today with Haulage Optimizer. Don and I have been out at the sites in the field working with the people. We've actually used these applications out there, and the supervisors and field leaders have, you know, very excitedly explained to us how it changes their day-to-day responsibilities, helps them, delivers better results for them that they can actually see, you know, and experience the benefit. So I think it's a great combination of all of those things that you pointed out. We're renewing systems, we're automating things, and making significant improvements all the way around. So I'm excited to be a part of it and very impressed with what's been accomplished to date.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We have no further questions on the line.
Okay, well, thank you.
Sorry, Don.
Go ahead, Fraser.
My apologies. Thanks. Thank you. So, Matt, I guess we'll start off the last session here, third and final session of the day. It's led by Marcia Smith, of course, our Senior Vice President of Sustainability and External Affairs. Marcia will provide an overview of Tech's commitment to ESG and our industry-leading performance. So, Marcia, over to you.
Great. Thank you very much, Fraser, and good afternoon, everyone. So today, as Fraser said, I'm going to give an overview of Tech's ESG performance and our strategy for continuing to meet the evolving ESG expectations moving forward. So moving to slide two, I'll start with an update on performance and achievements in each of health, safety, environment, and communities. I'm going to briefly review Teck's sustainability strategy and then provide a review of our climate-related performance, including the role of steelmaking coal in a low-carbon future. And finally, I'll close with an update on ESG resources for investors. So starting with the health component of health and safety, throughout 2021, COVID-19 remained one of the most material issues facing Teck and the world. We have a comprehensive approach to managing the risks and impacts of the pandemic based around five pillars: prevention, employee support, aid for communities and public health organizations, business continuity, and communications. So on the prevention side, we've continued to enhance protective measures in addition to the protocols that we've put in place in line with health guidance. We've also implemented pre-work rapid testing programs across our operations and major projects. And as a result, we've been able to maintain operations and continue the ramp up at our QB2 project. For employees, we've greatly expanded our mental health programs and also provided access to on-demand virtual health services. And we've launched programs to encourage vaccination, as well as on-site vaccination clinics, and we've provided a paid day off for employees to get vaccinated. We've also continued to support community and local health organizations through our $20 million COVID Community Relief Fund. And throughout the pandemic, we have maintained close contact with our employees, our stakeholders, health authorities, and unions to ensure that they understand and support the protective measures that we're putting in place. So moving to overall safety performance, as Don said, this is a core priority for Teck. Our company-wide safety performance in 2020 was the best on record for Teck, with performance in the first half of 2021 following similar downward trends in high potential incidents and lost time injury frequency. And we attribute some of this progress to the continued implementation of our high potential risk program, targeting potentially unsafe situations before any potential incident can occur. Now, despite this progress, we were saddened to report one fatality in January 2021 at our Red Dog operations. We have carried out an in-depth investigation to identify measures to prevent a reoccurrence of such an incident, and we are sharing the results to help strengthen performance across the mining sector. So for these next few slides, I'll say a few words about Teck's approach in each priority area. So starting with community, we engage with surrounding communities throughout the mining lifecycle, from exploration to development, operations, to closure and remediation, to create lasting benefits for all. And this includes generating approximately $10.8 billion in economic benefits in 2020, which includes spending with local suppliers, payments to various levels of government, and wages, and prioritizing hiring from within the areas where we operate, with 72% local employment across operations. On our work with Indigenous peoples, we focus on early engagement, and we work to achieve the free, prior, and informed consent for Teck's activities in the traditional territory of Indigenous peoples. An important part of that is establishing formal agreements, and we currently have 72 active Indigenous agreements in place covering all of our operations. We also work to advance reconciliation through support for numerous Indigenous-led organizations, and we focus on creating economic opportunities for Indigenous communities, including investing $192 million with Indigenous businesses last year alone. So moving on to water on slide six, we work to protect water quality and reduce our use of fresh water in water-scarce regions. Two of our major undertakings are the continued implementation of the Elk Valley Water Quality Plan at our steelmaking coal operations in British Columbia. And as Robin said, by the end of 2021, we plan to have capacity to treat more than 54 million liters of water per day in the Elk Valley, and that is nearly three times our 2020 treatment capacity. And in Chile, we're focused on reducing the use of fresh water. That includes construction of a major desalination plant at our QB2 operations, which will be the first large-scale use of desalinated seawater for copper production in the Tarapacá region of Chile. On tailings management, we are committed to meeting global best practices for safe and responsible tailings facilities, and we're proud to have been part of the efforts to develop the global industry standard on tailings management. And because of our existing mature tailings governance program, we already meet about 75% of the global tailings standards requirements at our sites, and we're in the process of completing full implementation. This is largely around developing stronger community engagement programs on tailings management. And our plan is to complete that work no later than August 2023. So moving to slide 7, biodiversity and reclamation. We are working towards a commitment that we actually made back in 2011 to have a net positive impact on biodiversity. And this includes working in cooperation with groups, including Indigenous communities and others, on conservation initiatives. For example, in January of this year, we signed a joint management agreement with the Tanaha Nation for over 7,000 hectares of land near our steelmaking coal operations that have been set aside for conservation. Further, in our effort to be a responsible producer, we continue to focus on reducing waste and pollution while increasing recycling activities, including recycling of electronics or urban ore at our Trail smelter to reclaim valuable metals, with over 43,000 tons of urban ore recycled last year alone. On slide 8, at Teck, we are working to foster a culture of equity, inclusion, and diversity, ensuring that our employees feel valued and equipped for their roles today and into the future. And for example, we're working to improve gender diversity across the company. And to date, 20% of our total workforce are women, ahead of the industry average of 15.7%. Over one quarter of all senior management roles are held by women today. And we're also committed to transparency and accountability in our governance practices. And this includes linking our compensation to sustainability performance through the integration into corporate, business, and personal components. So moving now from performance to strategy on slide 9, Teck has had a comprehensive sustainability strategy in place for over a decade. We update the strategy on a periodic basis, first in 2015, and we released a second major update last year. With the 2020 update, we set ambitious new goals in the 8 strategic themes shown here on the slide, from health and safety to tailings to climate change. And under each, there are long-term objectives with short-term milestone goals to guide our progress. So there's a lot of detail on each of the goals available on our website, but for our time today, I want to focus on climate change. So on the next slide, mining is by its nature, as the audience would know, a GHG emissions intensive business, and we recognize our responsibility to work to reduce emissions and support global action on climate change. Today, Teck is in an industry leading position when it comes to climate action. The carbon intensity of our operations is already very low. And as shown in the graphs here on the slide, the intensity of our Scope 1 and Scope 2 GHG emissions for each of our major products are already in the first or second quartile in the industry. And in fact, as Robin pointed out earlier, Teck's hard coking coal is amongst the highest quality in the world, with properties that improve blast furnace efficiency and decrease CO2 emissions per ton of steel. And this has positioned Teck's seaborne steelmaking coal as a preferred product for steelmakers as they begin to face rising carbon prices. And finally, I will say that the majority of our business is already covered by carbon pricing and has been so for many years. So unlike many of our peers, the cost of carbon is already factored into our cost structure. So moving from this strong starting position, we are implementing a comprehensive climate strategy organized around 4 pillars. The first is to ensure Teck's portfolio is well positioned for the low carbon economy. And central to that is, as Dawn discussed earlier today, rebalancing our portfolio towards copper, an essential metal for the low carbon transition. Second, we support adoption of carbon pricing as an effective and fair method of driving climate action broadly when applied equitably. Third, we're working to reduce our own carbon footprint, including setting a long-term climate goal of being carbon neutral across our operations by 2050. And our plan to achieve this 2050 goal includes several short-term milestone goals, including moving to renewable power for our Chilean operations and reducing the carbon emissions intensity of our operations by 33% by 2030. So we are continuing the implementation of our climate change policy, including working on our Scope 3 emissions through work with our customers and transportation providers to reduce downstream emissions. Finally, we are adapting to the physical impacts of climate change at our sites, incorporating climate scenarios into our project design and mine closure planning, and increasing the resilience of our operations. So we have been working on a roadmap for how we will reduce our carbon intensity to achieve this long-term objective of being carbon neutral by 2050. And so from now until 2030, our focus is on readily available, cost-competitive technologies. And our action in Chile to move towards renewable electricity reflects this approach, where we've been able to procure renewable electricity at competitive prices. We're also evaluating abatement opportunities across all of our sources of emissions, with a focus on mobile equipment, which represents our largest sources of emissions. And today, we're piloting projects such as electric crew buses and other heavy-duty electric vehicle options, such as concentrate haulers at Highland Valley Copper. And finally, we're also actively exploring early-stage adoption options for zero-emissions haul trucks. So moving to slide 13, beyond reducing the emissions of our own operations, we're also considering the resilience of our products in a low-carbon world, particularly steelmaking coal. And currently, the steel industry accounts for 7 to 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And as Don noted, many solutions have been proposed to decarbonize steel production. And we believe meeting global climate commitments will require deploying a range of steelmaking decarbonization technologies. Today, about 70% of steel is produced by a blast furnace, which requires coke made from steelmaking coal. And adapting blast furnaces with carbon capture utilization and storage technology is, we believe, going to be, at least in the short and near term, the most cost competitive and commercially viable decarbonization solution, leveraging the more than 1 trillion U.S. of existing blast furnace capacity. And as such, we see continued strong demand for high quality seaborne steelmaking coal through to 2050. So moving to slide 14, I'd like to close by highlighting our approach to reporting and to touch on external recognition of Teck's sustainability performance. We have issued sustainability reports for 20 years in alignment with the GRI frameworks. We also report in alignment with SASB standards, and we published 3 TCFD-aligned reports, the most recent of which we released just a couple of months ago. And finally, we have achieved industry-leading ESG performance, including being honored as the top-ranked mining company by both the Dow Jones Sustainability Index and Sustainalytics, and maintaining an A ranking with MSCI. And on slide 15, I invite you to access some of Teck's extensive ESG disclosure as listed here, all of which are available through our website. So in summary, Teck remains focused on leading ESG performance. We are well positioned for the low carbon transition with low carbon intensity production of the metals and minerals essential to the clean economy. We have strong health and safety, environmental and communities performance with a focus on continuous improvement as guided by our sustainability strategy. And that strong performance has been recognized by a number of external ESG ratings and rankings organizations. And so with that, I will turn it back to Fraser, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Marcia. We'll now take questions on Teck's ESG strategy, performance, and reporting. Don will be back on, of course, to moderate. Don, Marcia, and I will be joined by Red, and also Chris Adachi, who's our Director of Climate Change, and Scott Maloney, who's our Vice President of Environment. Other members of the senior management team are also available on the line to answer questions. As a reminder, again, just anybody who wants to ask a question, please dial into the conference center and limit questions to one. And with that, Matt, please open up the lines for questions.
Thank you. And once again, please press star 1 on your device keypad if you have a question. And we have no questions registered at this time.
We may have worn everyone out. why don't we then, I mean, we've got time slotted, everyone, whoever's still with us, for Q&A on sustainability, and of course, a wrap up with Dawn, so general Q&A.
And I'm sorry to...
Sorry, go ahead, Matt.
Yes, sorry to interrupt. We do have one question that queued up, if you would like to take it.
Oh, absolutely, please.
Thank you. The question is from Carlos de Alba of Morgan Stanley. Mr. D'Alba, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Great. Thank you very much. And sorry if I missed this, but could you make any comments on what are the key initiatives on Scope 3 for the coal business? If any.
Go ahead, Marcia.
Sure. Maybe the first, thanks Carlos for the question, and maybe the first point that I would make is that rebalancing our portfolio towards copper will shift our scope 1, 2, and 3 intensity of our portfolio to one that is lower in intensity, since carbon has a lower scope 3 emissions profile than the steelmaking coal business does. Having said that, as we've all talked about today, the steel sector is taking meaningful actions to decarbonize as they aim to deliver their own net zero emissions goals by 2050. So in terms of scope 3, we are committed to working with our customers and our logistics chain to better understand what options there are to decarbonize their business and to identify where we can help support their efforts. Maybe I would also just see if Chris wants to add anything there.
No, I think, Marcia, you hit the main points there. The only thing I'd add potentially is that we are looking at options as well in the supply chain. And I think there's some announcements that we anticipate in the coming month. But we are looking at all those options throughout the supply chain to see where we can support others.
All right. Thank you very much.
And maybe, Don, thank you, Carlos.
Oh, sorry.
Maybe, Don, I'll just say, I was just going to say there was a question earlier, and I'm sorry, Carlos, I don't know if it was from you, but there was a question earlier on glaciers, but I don't think we addressed. Someone asked a question. It was part of a multi-pronged question on glaciers, and I just wanted to say to whoever questioned that, the glacier issue that you're referring to in Chile, it does not have any impact on our QB2 or Carmenac and Andacollo operations. We have no involvement with glaciers. So just to close that loop on that question.
Thank you. Fraser, if there's no other questions on sustainability, why don't we move to like the final question session on anything and everything that people may want to ask?
Yeah, absolutely. We will do that. Just before we do, I was going to mention two things for people for their calendars, so don't do that at the very end. First, two events. First, we'll report our Q3 results on 27th of October. It'll be a conference call, as usual, 11 a.m. Eastern, and all the details will be released a little closer to the time of report. Second, absolutely more exciting, is that we are going to host a QB2 virtual site visit on Monday, November 1st, and we'll again have further details on that in the coming weeks. So with that, then, we go to the final Q&A, and we're going to have on-screen Don, Red, Jonathan, Marcia, and Nick. But, of course, all the members of the senior management team are free to are available to answer questions. And so with that, Matt, why don't you see if we have any other questions on any subject, including sustainability.
Yes, thank you. And we do have questions. The first question is from Lucas Pipes of B. Riley Securities. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon again, everybody. Rial, a quick question for you on CFR prices in China. Obviously, Teck has some nice exposure there in the Pacific market, 7.5 million tons, if I recall correctly. How would you describe the CFR market in regards to how it translates to netback prices? Major pitfalls that we should be aware of. I'm just always, sensitive when prices run up so quickly that things can rise along the way too, quality discounts, transportation, what have you. So just thought I asked that question. Would appreciate your perspective on that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Lucas. The current China CFR price is really high for sure, as you're pointing out. I mean, on average, it's sitting just below $580 U.S. per ton. But to your question, to word that back to an FOB price, the freight from Vancouver to China is currently in the US $25 to $30 range. So you need to deduct that, call it from 580 for round number. So that puts it in a very healthy 550 to 555 US dollar per ton. Now, what is supporting this and what are we watching? On the seaborne supply side, supply is down, as I said in the presentation, compared to pre-COVID, while steel production overall across the world is up significantly, 125 million tons versus 17 million tons lower on the steelmaking coal supply side. We're also watching, of course, the domestic supply in China. Domestic supply in China right now is running higher than last year. It is annualized at about a 9 million ton increase versus last year, bringing it to 494 million tons compared to 485 last year. And it doesn't seem like there's ongoing safety inspections at the mines. So it seems like doing any more than that would be difficult. Actually, the plus 9 million is probably a best case. And then, of course, we watch Mongolia. Mongolia, year-to-date exports to China are down. They're down. Actually, if you annualize the number, they're down another 9 million tons year over year to annualizing around 15 million. That is down from 24 last year and 34 pre-pandemic in 2019. So supply overall is continuing to be very tight, and we're seeing movement in the market by steelmakers in various markets trying to procure additional steelmaking coal as they're continuing to produce at very high level to capture the record high or near record high steel prices.
Very, very helpful. Thank you, Rael. I'll do a very quick follow-up. Many investors ask about, you know, the forward price for next year is still really, really healthy. Any interest in hedging out some of the coking coal price risk?
That's a good question, Lucas. But when you look at forward market for coal, it is still very thin, very small number of transactions. And if we were trying to hedge just one vessel alone, we could swing the market completely because the forward market is actually in very small clips of a few thousand tons compared to, you know, vessel sizes. If you take a Panamax, you're looking at 80, 85,000 tons. If you take a Capesize, you're looking at a minimum of 165,000 tons. So it is not really an alternative. There is no forward market really to hedge.
Thanks again, and best of luck, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Orest Wakoda of Scotiabank. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. You've outlined some potential development timelines for St. Nicholas and Zapparnel. I'm wondering if you can outline sort of what the timeline could be for QB3, and specifically not just a development decision there, but also when Teck would actually be contributing significant capital to fund that expansion.
Okay. Several of us could comment on that, but why don't we start actually with Nick, if you could explain then how the deal works with Sumitomo Metal Mining and Sumitomo Corp in terms of who puts in capital when, and then read it over to you on the timetable related to pre-feasibility filing of the SEIA and final feasibility and so on.
The contingent payment is equal to effectively 8% of the NPV of QB3. and that goes in a similar manner to their upfront payment did in the original transaction, which is, i.e., it gets spent first.
Okay, and Red?
Yeah, Oris, thanks. So we're heading into pre-feasibility now on QB3, and it's a very exciting deposit. That's been another fun thing for me to learn about in the past year. It's got great expansion potential. We could add an additional SAG line, pretty straightforward to that, but it would support much more than that. So the pre-feasibility is going to be looking at those options with a lot of focus on just adding one additional SAG line, which would be a 50% increase in the QB2 capacity to get to QB3. So though you can imagine those different approaches would have different timelines, but still they're well out in the future the way that timing works when Teck would actually have to be putting cash in if we were to continue down that path and sanction something.
Okay.
So to take those two things together, if you think about it, when we first did the deal and people thought of long-term copper prices as around $3 at that stage, to the extent that people have a view it might be $3.50 now, the value of the 8% of the NPV at that stage is much higher than we would have thought. And so the capital that Teck would have to come up with is, of course, that much lower. And so, and then of course you have project finance that would come after that. So really, Teck's equity commitment is probably 2027 or 2028, and it would be lower than what we otherwise would have thought. And that depends on which model of development it is. So we'll have quite a few years of lots of cash to return to shareholders before we're putting equity into QE3.
Okay. As a follow-up, it looks like the CapEx for St. Nicholas and Zafranal combined, even on a 100% basis, is only $2 billion. So if according to your timelines of potentially starting those in mid-23, it does sound like there's going to be a multi-year window here of positive free cash flow. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yes.
Thank you.
And then even more so if we partner on those assets in terms of our need to put up capital becomes that much less.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you. The next question is from Greg Barnes of TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Don, I'm going to jump the gun a little bit. With coal prices where they are, look like it's going to continue into Q4, is there a possibility of supplemental shareholder returns this year or early 2022, or is it going to wait until QB2 is done?
No, I think if you do the math, you have to make your own assumption on what not just coal prices, but all coal prices are going to be. But certainly anywhere near these levels, our capital allocation framework would produce a healthy number of available cash flow. And Jonathan, took the group through how that works. And so we would make a decision on that at the board meeting in February when we have all the final results there. So I'm not going to predict what it is, but certainly our models show that there would be available cash flow.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And next question is from Matthew Murphy of Barclays. Please go ahead.
Hi. Another one on coal. Can you remind me on the contract volumes, which time of month do the assessments tend to happen? Is it a consistent time of the month? Just given the rally, want to make sure I'm capturing that right. And then does the price action that you've seen and that your assessment of the market make you want to shift your volumes at all, trying to get more into China or vice versa?
Okay, Rael, back to you.
All right, thanks, Matthew. I'll answer the second question first. We keep looking to maximize tons for our sales to China, but of course, we're continuing to supply into our long-term, highly stable and reliable customers that it took us years to develop. So Currently, our target is around 7.5 million ton sales to China for 2021. We're well on track to do that. There's good reason to do this, as you say, with the prices that we're seeing right now. Now, in terms of our book, China at around 7.5 million tons is about 30% of our sales. The sales in China are priced around 4 to 6 weeks ahead of the start of the load port laycan for the vessels. So we're always kind of about a month to 6 weeks behind price. Another 40% of our book is with our long-term customers, where the price is calculated on the average of the FOB Australia assessments lagged by 1 month. So what that means for the current quarter, for Q3, is that the average, that price for the quarter has already been set. The average is at just under 203 US per ton. That compares to 117 US per ton in Q2, and it was 122 US per ton in Q1 this year. So we are seeing benefits in Q3 for those quarterly priced sales. But of course, the balance of our sales that are sold on the spot market, we're seeing benefits, like I say, 4 to 6 weeks behind actual price in the market as tons are reflected.
Okay, I understand that there are no more questions at this time. So I just want to say to everybody, thank you very much for joining us today. If we have missed anyone with questions, please feel free to reach out to Fraser and other members of our investor relations team. We'll be happy to get back to you. And we look forward to hosting our annual Investor and Analyst Day in person next year. I certainly hope that comes to pass. Lastly, I want to say a special thank you to my team, to Fraser and Laurie and Ellen and our newest addition, Helen, for working so hard to put this session together today. I think you've done a great job. And thank you to the rest of the senior management team for being available for these questions. We wish you all very well. Thank you very much. Bye now.
Thank you. The conference is now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and we thank you for your participation.